Okay, good afternoon and welcome to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, June 22, 2022. This virtual meeting is being held under Governor Inslee's COVID-19 Notice of Proclamation 28-2028, and we will be offering a live public comment period during the business section of our meeting. You may join us live on Microsoft Teams meeting through our website at www.jeffersonhealthcare.org, select About Us, then Hospital Commission, and scroll down to the links. You may also join audio only at 509-598-2842 and enter ID number 38368-2973 pound. The session is being officially audio recorded, and time shown on the agenda are estimate only. All commissioners and our CEO are present, and I now call for a move to approve today's agenda.
So move.
Is there a second?
Second.
A discussion? Second. All in favor, raise your hand. Okay, that's unanimous. Thank you. And before we go any further, I wanted to thank Brittany Huntingford for her work that she did during the time that Alyssa was on leave. She did an amazing job, and we're very grateful to her. And I'd also like to welcome back Alyssa Rodriguez, and she will be here today recording us and from now on. So welcome back, Alyssa. And we'll go right into governance discussion. So as you know, we scheduled a generative governance workshop meeting on Tuesday, July 5th at 2, and our major discussion will focus on our first priority of the master plan. And we know that there are restrictions regarding commissioners advocating for any possible ballot measures that might be part of that plan. Our guests for our education topic will help us understand those regulations, and we will be able to ask him questions. And I am very pleased to welcome our education session guest, Matt Ellsworth. He is the executive director of the Association of Washington Public Hospital Districts, or AWPHD for short. Matt brings his extensive political, community development, and public policy and management experience to AWPHD and to partner with WSHA to increase effective governance and operations of public hospital districts across the state of Washington. And today, he brings that experience to help guide us in our master plan process. It's good to have you with us, Matt. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. So for today, with the understanding of this group taking some consideration of going to your voters for support, I wanted to take some time with you and share what I've been sharing with a lot of other PhDs who are having the same discussion right now. Some of the ins and outs and what it means to be a commissioner during an election process. In this case, we're going to use the term bond. And some of the do's and don'ts, some advice about how to appropriately interact with your constituency and how to stay compliant. And ultimately, at the end of the day, to execute your function of supporting your PhD. I'll start by saying that I am not an attorney. And of course, as you go through this process, I would encourage you to consult with one yourself. The materials I'm presenting to you today have been vetted and widely shared with legal counsel, so I have confidence in that. I do know in the packet I'm going to be referencing a handout of the do's and don'ts. It's a two-page front and back white paper. One column says do, one column says don't, so we'll come back to that. I am going to share my screen and go through a few quick slides. And I'll kind of pop in and out of those for some discussion, and then we can have some Q&A if that's okay with you, Madam Chair.
It sounds wonderful. Perfect.
Okay. Well, I'm going to hit a screen share here. Does everybody see that?
Yep.
Yes. Okay, great. So where I want to begin is a little bit about some context of the PhD environment when it comes to elections. The first thing I'm going to say is that historically, PhDs struggle in this area. On the average, over the past 5 years, less than 20% of PhD levies pass. However, of those that lose, they lose by a margin of less than 3%. So what does that mean? Quite frankly, and by way of background, I ran the campaign of two current U.S. senators, and I've run a lot of campaigns, and a 3% margin of loss is a gut punch. And some of the things we're going to talk about today is really what that 3% difference means and where it lies. And a lot of that lies in the efforts of what those things that you as a commission can do. You know, another thing we're going to talk a little bit about is something I call ballot fatigue. So depending on when you choose your election, quite frankly, you're the last page on the ballot. And so one of the challenges we have in PhDs is, one, people knowing that there's an effort out there on behalf of the PhD to ask their voters for these kinds of things, but also getting them to get to the last page of the ballot. It's statistically proven that when people get ballots, the longer they are, you really got to work extra hard to get them to the back page. Little antidote I like to share is that for those of you that were around in California, when Arnold Schwarzenegger was elected, Arnold Schwarzenegger, that year they had 4 pages to the ballot. And then Arnold Schwarzenegger won. And they actually went back and did a ballot survey, and they found out that Arnold Schwarzenegger got a 2% bump because his name was longer than the rest. It stuck out further because people were so tired of reading all the names, they just went to the one that stuck out. It's like when they put a red star next to something on a something good on an Italian food menu. So that's one of the challenges we also face. And then finally, who the heck are these people? What is a PhD? We have found through surveying constituents across the state that most people don't understand that you're publicly owned and operated. They know you're a hospital. In this case, you share the name with your county. You share the name with your district. That's not always the case. But yet there is still that misunderstanding that lies out there with the voters. And so another challenge you have is that, one, not just having people understand there's an opportunity to support you on the ballot, but in fact, you're publicly owned. And we're going to come back later to this a little bit about the value of that and what public ownership means. And as I like to say, skin in the game. One of the messages that I use with folks and when it comes to public hospital districts is one of the top concerns across voters when it comes to healthcare is they feel like they don't have a say. Well, what a better opportunity to have the say in the future of your healthcare than actually a public hospital district where you get to participate and vote not only on women and men like yourself as leaders, but also on how it's financed and the future vision of that. Don't worry, I only have 4 slides, so we can talk a lot. I want to visit a little bit about what an election looks like. So this is the election evolution, as I call it. The first thing you do is you after you've made that decision to go to your voters and what you're going to ask for, you choose a date. Here in the state of Washington, we have a few options. Quite frankly, there's some politics at play as to why you may choose one of those dates. But then once you choose that date, then you begin the pre-work. And what that is listen to your constituents. Understand what they're going to tolerate. Listen to your constituents, whether they're going to show up and vote. There's always questions about, are you the only one on the ballot? Is there a school district, a library district, my favorite, the mosquito abatement district? Are they going to the voters at the same time? Well, that has an effect. So take some time and listen, and then scope what you're going to ask for as a reaction to what people say. The next step to that is building that support out there. This goes everywhere from, and we're going to get to this on the do's and don'ts next. Do the employees support this vision for what's going to be their new workplace? Does the Chamber of Commerce, do your local political parties? Quite frankly, you're talking about taxation. Local political parties are very involved in issues of taxation. Does other units of government support this effort? So finding those groups that are going to have a say in this, that can coalesce and be advocates one way or another, around this effort, is important to understand where those groups lie and ask them to be engaged. Also as a sounding board for your efforts, but also listening to feedback, and then understanding whether they choose to go out and advocate. The next step is the roadshow. I used to be deputy chief of staff to a governor. And my boss came to me one day and he said, Ellsworth, if somebody's cat dies, I want you at the funeral. Well, guess what, folks? This is the chance to go to a lot of cat funerals. Wherever there is more than three people gathering in your community, it's an opportunity to share your knowledge about what's happening. Let's face it, this is a big deal in your community. And so where there's a group willing to listen, you should be willing to go. As you go through this process, you may develop a set of messages and talking points that explain what you're doing. Understand that amongst yourself so that you're all sharing that same message. So that when you talk about the dollar amount, make sure you all know that dollar amount. When you talk about those services that may grow and be offered, that you're all talking about the same those same services. And so it's really getting out there and exposing yourself as information ambassadors to anybody that will listen. I say this both for commissioners and for leadership staff at the hospital. And then finally, it's that get out the vote. After doing elections in other states, another quirk we have in Washington is not only do you have to get 60% mark, but you have to hit a certain number of votes total cast. And so making sure that people get out and vote, they know there's a campaign happening, and encouraging them and building some excitement about going out and participating in the elective process. And I'll come back to any of these slides when we get to questions here. So this is really the big one. This is the do's and don'ts and really what I want to focus our time on today. So really, if I could leave you with one headline, that headline is do not use district resources. And that applies to everything. I say to those of you on the commission today, when you ran for office, did you campaign for yourself? Mm-hmm. Absolutely, you did. Working on behalf of a board-directed ask to your voters like this, there's some nuance, but the reality is that a lot of the campaign rules are the same. So let's talk about what is a district resource. The easiest one, and one that tends to get violated the most, is email. So if you have an email address that says jeffersonhealthcare.org at the end, do not use that to advocate. So let's talk a little bit about the difference between education and advocacy. So you as a PhD are allowed to educate. What does that mean? So you can tell people this is what we're going to build. These are the services. This is what it's going to cost. And basically the facts about what the bond is offering. You can talk about your decision-making process, why you as a commission chose to put it on the ballot. All of that is fair game. Where advocacy begins is where you say to the voter, and I want you to vote yes or no. I would hope you'd say yes, but that's where advocacy begins. And so let me give you an example, because this will happen. Somebody sends you an email asking a question about this bond, and they send it to your official email. Can you answer that question? Yes, you can. You can answer that question, again, with the facts about the bond, your decision-making process. You can speak about it in a positive light. What you cannot do is say, and I would hope that you would vote yes. You cannot advocate. And so that's really where that nuance lies. I'm going to give you a few examples here. I'm going to stop sharing screen here for a sec so we can visit. If you have a room in the hospital right now, and do you let anybody in the community use that room?
No.
So let's say somebody uses that room and you charge them $15 to use that space. Can a campaign group use that space for $15?
No.
The answer is yes, they can.
Oh, really? Huh?
Because if you offer it to the public, you have to offer it to the entire public. And it has to be under those same terms. So in education, can Mike hold during the lunch hour for an entire week in the cafeteria of the hospital invite the board members to come and sit down and have a PowerPoint about what the bond is that will affect their future workplace. Absolutely, you can do that. And I encourage that because, quite frankly, they're affected as much as anybody else, aren't they? But where it stops short is you can't have a slide that says, now I want you to go tell your friends and family to vote yes. Even if you do that during the noon hour, because you're using a slide projector, how old is that, right? you're using projection equipment that's owned by the district. You may be using handouts printed by the district. Those are district resources. And so that's every time you're faced with this question, those are the really what that golden rule is. And when in doubt, ask. You could ask me. I'm happy to seek legal advice. I could seek the advice I already have. So now I want to take your attention to that sheet I handed out. I don't know if you had time to look at that, but the first thing I like to say is the column of what you can do, notice it's much longer than what you can't. Yeah. I'm here to tell you that the difference in that 3% lies within you. Somewhere along the line, there was, yes, Ken, you're on mute.
You're mute.
Thank you. Thanks for the info. What sheet are you referring to right now?
So I may have gotten to you late. I'm sure you will get it. I sent it to Brittany this morning to share with you. Okay, we'll make sure you get it.
Okay.
What it is, it's used amongst a lot of special purpose districts, which you are, and it is the legal what you can and can't do. So some examples. Can you have, as a commissioner, a bumper sticker that says vote yes? Well, yeah, that seems pretty simple, right? Can you park that car when you come to the meeting at the hospital, when you come down to have your monthly meeting one-on-one with Mike?
No.
Absolutely, you can.
Okay.
Let's take it one step further. Can you have a pickup truck with a 10x10 plywood sign in the back that says vote yes, and then come to a meeting on hospital property and park in the parking lot? Yes, you can. Now, can you leave it there for a week? No, you cannot. because at that point, that becomes a gift to the district. You are an individual. And so if you take, I'll give this another example and I'll go to there. So you're let's say you're all going to write a letter to the editor. I see one of our guests here today is Sound Publishing. So you're going to write a letter to the editor to Sound Publishing, and you're going to sign it Matthew Reedy. Can you sign it Matthew Reedy, Jefferson Public Hospital District Commissioner? Yes, you can. Look, you are all highly elected officials. You got your election certificate and you were outfitted with your togas, and here we are. Here's the example. So when there's an initiative on a statewide ballot, you see a TV ad with Jay Inslee, and it says Jay Inslee governor. That is his title, just as much your title is yours. That title is not property of the district. It is a title bequeathed upon you. And so you can do that. Now, can you sit here in a public meeting and when you're all draped in your togas and talk about why we need to pass this? No, you cannot. So there are some commonly referred to questions I get. What I'm driving at is that in the PhD world, and quite frankly, most special purpose districts, somewhere along the line, people got this belief that if we're elected officials, we just put it on the ballot and we walk away. We're not allowed to engage. And I'm here to tell you that nothing could be further from the truth. Just like you went out and campaigned for yourself as a sitting commissioner, you can go out and advocate for this. You just can't do it in a public meeting, and you cannot do it with district resources. Again, there's that very clear line. And so I'm going to come back to some of the reasons why people don't engage. It's politics, and it's not always fun. Now, I'm here to tell you that when Matthew writes that letter to the editor and he signs it, Public Hospital District Commissioner, I guarantee you somebody is going to complain to you. And somebody's going to say, well, you violated the law. You can't do that. Somebody's going to come to you in the grocery store put their finger in your chest and say, you rotten, rah, 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 I can't believe you're running this bond. Ladies and gentlemen, that's what leadership is. That's what you signed up for. And if you place this on the ballot, that is the position of this commission. And it's, you have a duty to your public to inform them about what is happening. Don't be afraid to do that. And then when you walk off campus of the hospital district property and you choose to become advocates, taking a position in leadership is what it's all about. And so if you want to knock on doors, you can knock on doors. If you want to make phone calls, you can make phone calls. All of that is allowed. Now, don't make a phone call from Mike's office, because, again, that is a district resource. I know I'm kind of becoming a broken record here, but there's a reason I'm becoming a broken record. All of these same things I'm saying to you also applies to district employees. It applies to Mike. So Mike is going to get a lot of emails asking questions. He can answer them in an educational way, but he can't advocate. If there's an outside group that is actively advocating and campaigning, can you as commissioner sit on that campaign committee? Yes, you can. Can Mike? Yes, he can. However, when you're together doing that, don't conduct district business. The same public gathering rules apply anywhere else. And Mike, if he chooses to go to a campaign committee meeting at 2 p.m, he darn well better be taking PTO time to do that, because his time is owned and paid for by the district. And so, again, your time is a district resource as much as anything else. Yes, Ken.
Yeah, Case is the name. Nice to meet you, Matt.
Oh, sorry, I misread that.
here's an example. If you that I'd love to have you answer for me. I gave a presentation to a group called Indivisible PT, Indivisible Port Townsend. They were concerned about secular healthcare in this county. Because there's a group in Kitsap that's really totally fired up and concerned because of what's happening to some of the local hospitals. I used a bunch of Mike's slides to sort of formulate that. And I did it on my own time. I was identified as a public hospital district commissioner. And at that meeting, I actually said, if you want to preserve secular healthcare in this county, I would urge you to support Jefferson Healthcare. And we'll be coming forward with a bond. And I urge you to support it. Given what you've just said, I think I was okay with doing that.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
I would agree. And so the next question is, oh, no, you used Mike's slides.
No. Well, hold on.
No, hold on. But this is a good example. And let me tell you why that was okay. Because as you know, you're a public hospital district and Mike's slides are public information.
Good.
Go ahead.
I did get notified by somebody from that group that said that somebody from the leader was there. And that they weren't going to report me for having violated the law by having advocated for it. They were going to let me slide, but they said I might want to be careful in the future.
Yeah, they were wrong. and you're going to face this a lot. Quite frankly, not everybody has the benefit of the education that we're undertaking today. And I want to empower you with the right information so that you have the confidence to go and do what you just did. You were not on district property. You're not a district employee. And by the way, that's important to note. None of you are district employees under Washington state law. And you weren't using district resources. So that was absolutely okay what you did.
Aren't we employees?
You are not.
We get benefits through the public hospital district.
I understand. You are not employees of the district, you technically are the district as the commission. We researched this very much so during COVID when we were visiting about mandates and whether they applied to commissioners. You are not employees. So everything you did in that situation was absolutely allowable. But it's a good example to talk about because you're going to have folks say, well, wait a minute. And usually the people who are saying that are people who are opposing you, quite frankly. But again, that's what leadership is. And for you to say, actually, I am doing this right. And if you'd like to talk more about that, we can. Yes, Bruce.
So following up on what Kay said, so to me, it seems like there's a fine line between educating and explaining why we need this bond. And as commissioners, we can, away from the hospital, not using any of their resources, we can advocate for it. Now, if Mike had been there, he could, correct me if I'm wrong, I think he could say why we believe we need this expansion and why, and this is how we can afford it. But he couldn't say, even though he's on his own time, he's taking personal time off to be there. It wouldn't be okay for him to say, and we want you to vote it the way the case did.
Incorrect. If it's a Saturday afternoon at the Rotary picnic, he absolutely can say vote yes. Although time is a district resource, and I know Mike works more than 40 hours a week on your behalf, you don't own all of his time. And so, yes, he could. Again, if he wasn't there on district time using district resources. Yes, Marie.
Because we need to get 60% of the, of the votes cast in a previous highest election or something like that, we can still urge people to vote without saying vote yes or vote no, correct?
Yes, because that's a very good point.
We've got to get the vote out, right?
Right. So I'm going to move on to the next slide, and I'm going to address that directly about how you do that with district resources in a compliant way. One last point on this, that frequently asked questions will be on that sheet, but always feel free to ask. During election season, I get the what if calls all the time. I want to talk to you a little bit about what wins and what loses as far as messages within your community. And then the value of understanding that there may be, and most PhDs have a outside campaign committee that does this and does the quite frankly, fills in that thing that you can't do. You as a public hospital district, two features that I will share with you real quick. You are allowed as a district to do one mailer at district cost that educates. And you can talk about the benefits. Let's say you're going to expand the number of beds. That's a benefit. You can say more beds will be provided. You can say those things. You can say on your communications, vote November 8th. You can say that. What you can't say is please vote yes. So getting out the vote, Marie, to answer your question, you absolutely can do. Let's talk about that district communication. If you have a regularly occurring communication already, let's say you do a monthly newsletter, you can educate in that newsletter to your voters about this issue. What you can't do is go and all of a sudden create a new monthly newsletter you've never done before. It has to already be established and exist. Social media. Social media already exists. You can use that to, again, educate because that is a district resource and it is owned by the district. And so if you wanted to have a posting every day about one of the aspects of the bond, today we're going to talk about expand elder care. Today we're going to talk about cancer care. You can do that, again, without advocating. One caveat there in the social media world as a public district is you're going to get a lot of comments. Those comments are going to be political in nature. So if somebody says, this is rotten, I want to vote no, how do you respond when you can't respond in a political way? Personally, my advice is don't. But as an example, it's already an established method of communication that you can use. Now, other groups, let's say your foundation, you may have a community activist group, AWPHD, they can go out and advocate on your behalf and spend money and do those kinds of things as long as they're compliant with state law. So if they go and expend funds over a certain amount, they have to report that. And that's all spelled out very specifically. And quite frankly, some more attorney advice is something I would recommend on that. So other groups can, in fact, do that because they are not you. But again, can you be on that committee that does that? Absolutely, yes. I'm going to talk a little bit about, let's go back to that 20% loss and that 3%. So why do people support PhD election efforts? One is community ownership. They have skin in the game. This is, you know, people vote for school bonds even though they don't have kids in school. Why? Because they want smart kids. Well, we want healthy neighbors. And so that community ownership piece of that is a big part of it. Like I said earlier, if you're concerned about the future of your healthcare, what a better opportunity to take ownership of your future of healthcare than participating in an election like this? Demonstrating the value. You know, what are people getting for their money? Is it tangible? Is it something they believe in? Is it something they want? Are you growing your community or are you just building big statues to yourselves? Engagement wins. Just like I talked about before, having members like you out there and being that ambassador of information, that's what wins these elections, is being engaged. This has happened a lot in the past throughout communities in the PhD world. They put it on the ballot. They said, well, we've done our job. And then they go in a foxhole. That quite frankly, doesn't win. It's that engagement that wins. Engaging, again, with your staff. Quite frankly, your staff live in your community. Your staff have family members that are going to want to participate in this election. And they've got some real skin in this game, too. Leveraging the trust. First and foremost, demonstrating to your PhD that you've been a good PhD. You've been good stewards of your dollars. You're not a wasteful PhD. Show them that the money that the community has invested in you so far has been worth it and valuable. Those other people in the community that trust Jefferson Health, make sure they're speaking out on your behalf as community advocates. And so what you see here is building a domain of folks around this so that voters, one, know that it's happening, and then two, have a real understanding of why it's important that they participate. What turns people off? It could be worse. We have a former campaign of a PhD that put out a postcard that listed all the taxing districts in the county and showed them right in the middle. And I looked at that and I said, so you're telling me as a voter it could be worse? You need to be positive. I always say in my personal life and in my leadership, live life through the windshield. I take the rearview mirror off the window and throw it out the side. Be forward looking. Show that value and show why you're engaging in this. The end is near. Campaigns that if you don't do this, people will die. If you don't do this, the building will collapse at any moment. It's unsafe. If you don't do this, dot, dot, dot. Quite frankly, people are, that scares people. The natural instinct is, well, if we tell people how bad it is, they're going to support us. Quite frankly, the more negative campaign it becomes, people stay home and don't vote. And as Marie pointed out, you got to get that certain number of votes. You want people participating at overall. And so keep it positive. Complacency, we talked about. And then finally, going it alone. Not having other folks in your community engaged and not asking for advice from folks like AWPHD. I'm going to give you some resources on the next page and asking folks to help you. This is a big lift. as I like to say, you as commissioners, and quite frankly, your foundation, you know, when you read their mission statement, it says to support the long-term viability of Jefferson Healthcare. There is no greater single thing you can do to secure the future of Jefferson Healthcare than pass this. You've already shown that leadership to put it on the ballot. And so everybody needs to find other folks in the community to help bridge that understanding. Finally, before we do some questions, these are some other resources that are out there. AW PhD, we created a toolkit. It's a page on our website, as you see there. I know many of you may have participated. We did a webinar that contains some legal advice, some political strategic advice, and I would encourage you to watch that. MRSC, I know this group is very familiar with. They can help with compliance, the process of writing your resolution, what those look like, some examples, and then also a lot of those what if questions. And then finally, your county auditor. Your county auditor is the one who's going to set that threshold for how many votes you have to get. They're going to, you can utilize your auditor for when you send your mail piece, who the heck lives within the district to send that to. And so they're going to be a resource as well. I'd also encourage you to visit with your auditor now so you understand the overall election environment. Who else is on the ballot? Is there a school district, a fire district? Again, mosquito abatement. If all of a sudden we've got six people on the ballot asking the taxpayers for support at once, that changes the political environment. So you need to understand if that's going to be out there. So with that, I've talked a lot. I wanted to offer some space for discussion. I'll answer what I can appropriately for this group. I am always a resource. As you go into this endeavor, this is not the last you're going to see of AW PhD. As you have future discussions about this or work groups, I'm always happy to come back. Any other questions or comments from the group or things that I could help beyond that? You didn't even ask me why you don't have togas yet.
Just to let everybody know that Alyssa has posted the two-page direction, the do's and the don'ts from you.
Great.
In our emails.
Oh, great.
You're going to find it's pretty comprehensive. We tend to take the incoming do's and don'ts and add to that list all the time. If it's not on there now, it probably will be after the next election.
Would you mind explaining again why we are not employees? You said something like, we're not employees of the district because we are the district.
That's correct. So even though you receive compensation from the district, in essence, you're paying yourself as the district itself. Under the RCWs, I'll give you an example. There's only three ways you can be removed from office as a commissioner. One of them is unfortunately death. The other one is you can be recalled. And the third one is actually absenteeism. And so there's no other function for you to be removed as a commissioner. But along that lines of thinking, that's a demonstration of if you were an employee, then you could be fired. Quite frankly, you hire your one, you're responsible for hiring one employee, and that's your CEO. So it's actually very clear in the RCW that you're not employees.
Thank you.
You feel like you are when I know, but this was very well vetted because during the pandemic, we had commissioners ask, well, are we subject to the vaccine mandate? And we did our research and viewed it through the lens of, well, the vaccine mandate required employees of the district. And the ultimate ruling on that was that no, in fact, commissioners are not. I still encourage all of you to get your vaccines.
Amen.
Yeah.
Mike, did you have something?
Nope.
Okay.
I had a question. I know that one of the elements of our master plan is we have to replace a building that was built in '65, and we have mentioned that to the this is a mandate that we must do this. It's substandard. It was built obviously before a lot of the current permits were enacted, and so it's we have used that to talk to our people about our community about why we're doing this, and we felt that it was a very powerful motivation for it. But the advice here is not to use something like that.
Let me be clear. I think that's important because it shows value about why you're doing it. I'm sure you may want to talk about the efficiency and cost savings of having a building that you're not always replacing drywall in. What I meant to say is that I would avoid language like it could collapse at any time. People will get hurt. It's not safe to come here. I would advise against that kind of language. Other PhDs have used that language and it didn't work. I do think it's okay to talk about the value and why you're doing it.
Yeah, Jill, I would like to clarify that too, that the tier two structural and seismic report that we had to complete while we were going through the permitting process for the ESSB identifies some serious structural and seismic vulnerabilities and building deficiencies in the 65 building, and strongly recommends that they be addressed in 7 to 11 years. That document was presented to some of the permitting jurisdictions, and it was pointed out that what's your plan for this, and then elements of it were indicated that needed to be addressed within that 7 to 11 year window. It stopped short of saying it needs to be addressed. We are choosing to demolish and rebuild as opposed to remodel the entire structure because we think it's the better plan. But I think it's an important distinction to make that it isn't a mandate. I mean, I speak to it as more of a moral mandate that this document has indicated this building is outlived its useful life. And that's pretty heavy for us as leadership of Jefferson Healthcare to know. But it isn't a governmental mandate.
I understand that, okay. And I probably use the wrong term. In my mind, it's a mandate because it's been advised that we replace it, and so that's I shouldn't have used the term mandated. Heard that it was coming from on high,
this is a really good example of behavior going forward. Is that I think you as a commission and together with the hospital leadership need to develop a very simple one page. These are the core tenets of why we're doing this. These are the reasons why we're asking our voters to answer this question of whether they should support this. In the future. This is our education piece. And then having all of you as commissioners agree to what those tenets are, I think you are in agreement already, but spelling them out and then utilizing that as a tool everywhere you go. You're giving the same message to your community. You're consistent. Yes, Keys.
I've got a question about the taxes and levies. I looked at my property tax, and about 0.75 of 1%, less than 1% of my in-city property tax goes to Jefferson Healthcare. And you had mentioned this thing about showing people levies and all that kind of stuff, and it could be worse or whatever. I checked in the county, it's about 0.83% that goes to Jefferson Healthcare. I'm assuming that that kind of conversation is perfectly reasonable and is a driving force, because so little goes to support currently of taxpayer money goes to support Jefferson Healthcare.
Yes, not only is it appropriate, I think it's expected. People want to know what the impact is to them. And I think that talking about, you know, you hear people talk about, well, this is your cost per $100,000. That's a popular term to use in these kinds of discussions or framework. But it is. I think people, let's not hide the fact that this is taxation. And people, you know, they're going to view this as healthcare, but they're also going to view this as taxation. And so I think you need to be transparent. You need to tell people what that impact's going to be. Don't be afraid of what that number really is. Tell them you have an obligation to tell them what those numbers really are. Now, if Keys, you choose to say, one person may say, oh my gosh, it's 0.8%. And you may say, well, it's only 0.8%. People have different views of these matters, but I think absolutely that discussion is expected. Bruce?
Yeah, I think the other thing, Case, along with that is that, you know, that you can look on the positive side that in the past, we haven't had to go to the voters for a bond. We've done, you know, like with the past expansion, we didn't have to do that. But this case, it is necessary. The other thing, Matt, that I have a question about is that Case brought it up at his meeting that somebody from, I don't know if it was from the paper or whatever, says, I'm not going to report you this time. They obviously thought he'd stepped over the line. And we're going to get that because there's people that think they know more than the Public Disclosure Commission. And they'll file complaints. And the paper will pick up on those that, you know, we've had complaints filed about us. Is there anything we can do about that other than just make sure we are completely in compliance?
Well, one, yes, make sure you are completely in compliance. Yeah, you're always going to get that. I would hope that any member of the media that is reporting on these matters are reporting on the facts of the public disclosure law. And if they're reporting on those facts, they're going to report the fact that you are, in fact, in compliance. I don't think it's a news story that people are complaining about political activity. come on, folks, this happens every day. I think it's irresponsible to write a story that says all these people complained, but guess what? They were wrong. I think you're going to have to take the complaints as they go. I think you have to be confident as your answer to say, no, I am in compliance. You can invite them for a conversation. Say, well, please show me where you believe I'm out of compliance. And then I'm happy to give you the confidence of the answer. Say, and by the way, when somebody says, well, I'm going to report you because you're out of compliance, Keys, if you said, well, let's have a discussion, would you tell me where I'm out of compliance before you're going to, quote unquote, report me to this mythical, magical thing? And ask them to be transparent with you so you can be transparent with the answer. And I'm here to tell you that in that situation, they could not produce the answer about why you're out of compliance other than how they feel. I know I don't want to go over my time here either. So, Marie, did you have one last question?
Well, I was just thinking, and, you know, Case was saying about he pays Case 0.75% of your total taxes to the hospital district. Should one compare that to the school district saying, whereas I pay, okay, such and
no.
such?
That was done by another district, and they had a bar graph, and they were right in the middle, and that's the one I picked up, and I said, so you're telling me it could be worse. Stand on your own ground. Demonstrate the value, quite frankly, if you pay 0.075 now, we're going to demonstrate to you why you want to pay more to support us. That's what also, the argument is.
Also, would you say, so with this bond, I'll only be paying 1.2%?
Sure. Yes, I think that you're going to get asked that question a lot, and you need to be prepared to answer it.
Thanks.
However, again, when you make your fact sheet for the folks, that's going to be a part of it. As political advice, if I were talking to a campaign committee, of which you are not, I would say that, again, who cares what the tax rate was in the future? Talk about the value of what you're going to do and the fact that it's worth this new tax rate.
Another quick question, if I might.
Yes, sir.
Have other PhDs typically hired outside advocate groups in order to run their campaign in the community? We have a few people in this community who did an amazing job. They were paid by the public school or the Port Townsend School District, and they just did an incredible amount of, I mean, in fact, I did doorbelling for that group. What's the record for?
So I'm going to give you a bit of a two-part answer. Other PhDs do hire outside groups to do their PhD effort. So to work with you on what that mail is going to look like, how, and by the way, you can use district funds for this, to hire a group to help you educate your voters, to help you coordinate your schedules about how you educate people. You can do that as an education consultant. It's no different than hiring a janitor service. You go through a contracting process, and as long as they stay within that education lane, you as a PhD can do that. Can you hire an outside group to go advocate? No, you cannot. What happens in other PhDs is a community group may form. Other hospital foundations take this on sometimes. And that foundation can go and hire a political group to go and push a message of vote yes. They can do that, but no district funds can be used for that. And so when you say a school district did this before, I think you need to go review and say, was that the district itself, or was that an outside group such as the PT Citizens for Schools group doing it? So there's a distinction there. But I hope that answered the question. Both can hire. You can't cross the money, but one can say yes and one can advocate.
And I'll make sure that I clarify with the school district before I use that example.
And so if there is such a group formed, that Jefferson Healthcare or Citizens for Jefferson Healthcare bond measure, can any and all of the commissioners be a member of that group?
Absolutely, you can. You can also contribute money to that group. The difference is that you can't organize. If that group meets on the every Tuesday and they send out a meeting notice, they can't send it to jeffersonhealthcare.org because that's a district resource. And you can't host them to have that committee campaign meeting there in your hearing chambers during an official meeting. Yes, all of you can go and be a part of that. You can support it financially. You can support it with your time. Keys mentioned doorbelling. You can do all those things. And you can all be there together. You just have to be very, very careful that you're not conducting district business. Keep in mind that an effort to promote, advocate, vote yes or no, I'd hope it'd be yes, is not a district function. And that is not a board meeting, and advocating yes is not board business. So you can sit there and talk about the bond, and you can talk about voting yes within that group, and you're not conducting board business.
Wow.
So if we all five got together and discussed this in a meeting, would we be subject to the Open Public Meetings Act?
Yes, you would. that there has to be a group form that you're participating in. The five of you cannot form that group, and you cannot solely be that group. I think legally that's very questionable, but I also don't think the community would appreciate the optics of that. And quite frankly, you want to demonstrate that you have support beyond just the five of you.
Yeah, Matt, I think the question was, if this other group was formed and there's 10 or 15 people in it, could five commissioners show up and be five of 20 and not violate the Open Public Meeting Act?
Yes, you can. You just have to be very, very diligent. And I mean, if diligent is 10, you guys need to be a 15 about not discussing district business while you're there. It's no different than if y'all have a holiday party together.
So I should be using my personal email for anything relating to advocacy?
Absolutely, yes.
For this bond, yes.
Yes, and I will say, people are going to email you on your official email account asking about this. You can answer, but only answer in the educate. In other words, go back to that fact sheet we're going to produce, you're going to produce, and give them answers off that. Or you can direct them somewhere else. Say, hey, Mike's coordinate. I'm going to forward this on to Mike. But you're going to get questions like that. Resist the temptation at the end to say, and I sure hope you'd support it. You can talk positively about it. You just can't ask them to vote yes, Marie.
What I've done in the past with anything like that, I've forwarded it from my hospital email to my personal email and answered it from my personal email.
Right. And of course, there would be a public record of that.
And is there a public record? Is my personal advocacy email part of the public record?
It is not. The only way it would become part of the public record is if it includes somebody's, let's say it's a group of email of 10 people, and one of those people has a hospital email address, then the entire thing becomes public.
Right.
Which that is a rule that applies to everything, not just this. I would also caution you, be careful. It goes both ways. Never, ever conduct official business on your private email.
Right.
Hey, Matt, this may be a distinction without a difference, but can you violate the advocating for a ballot measure PDC requirement or prohibition if you speak and maybe or even advocate before the ballot measure is placed on the ballot or even addressed and voted on the ballot?
That is a good distinction. I think that I would avoid that. If it's not district resources, you can advocate all you want. Again, if it's not district resources, I think right now you have an opportunity to do a lot of education, and you can do that in an official capacity. But whether it's on the ballot or not, one could argue that, well, it's not on the ballot. It's a mythical concept. It's not really true, so we can get away with more. I would avoid that.
Great.
Okay. Thanks. Well, I know I've taken a lot of your time. I apologize if I went over, but I think this is important stuff. I will. Like I said, this will not be the last you hear of me. I'm going to continue to be a resource. Mike and I talk all the time too. He knows where to find me. And so those what if questions are going to come up. Continue to send them my way, and we're going to be with you all through the whole trail.
That's great. Well, thank you, Matt, so much. This is invaluable. And I'm going to hold you to that promise about helping us with that meeting.
You bet. Thanks again.
I also want to thank Matt and also just reiterate what he has been sharing with public hospital district administrators for the last 18 months. And that is, as the Wash State, the AW PhD has sort of been reinventing itself or partial transforming itself and looking for ways in which it can add the most value to public hospital districts. This area has surfaced to the top. When Matt went out and spoke with different hospital administrators and commissioners, they all said, you know, this is such an important part of our future, but it's an area that, you know, as I mentioned to all of you, I've been doing this for 30 years and I've never been involved in a bond effort.
Wow.
So and some people may have been a couple. So it's so important for the future of healthcare in rural communities. There are so many landmines that out of just by virtue of us being unaware of what they are and where they are, you could inadvertently step into. So Matt has pledged his expertise and AWP PhD resources to help public hospital districts educate their community to make the wisest decisions relative to the future of healthcare in their district. So I appreciate that, Matt, and we'll ring you when we need to.
Okay. Take care, everybody.
Thanks. Matt. Thank you. Okay. All right. At this time, then, we will conclude this section of our meeting and be back. We'll reconvene at 3:30 for the business section of our meeting. Thank you, everyone. See you then. Okay. Welcome back to the business portion of the June 22nd, 2022 Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting. We will have an executive session to discuss the lease or purchase of real estate towards the end of our meeting, and action may be taken. So now we begin with a patient story from Chief Nursing Officer Tina Toner. Welcome, Tina.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon. I am excited to present a letter that we received recognizing some really good news that we had. And in fact, both Brandy and I were very excited about it. So my letter I'm reading is a little bit of a teaser for some more information that she is going to be sharing in her quality report. So what this is about is, I'll just read this letter. It says, I recently received a newsletter which included a link to a story about top-rated hospitals for patient experience across the United States. I was delighted to see that Jefferson Healthcare is one of the two hospitals in our state that received a 5-star rating for patient experience. The high rating confirms my own experience with Jefferson Healthcare. As a patient, my experiences at Jefferson Healthcare have very rarely been disappointing and are often very satisfying. Patient care at Jefferson Healthcare is outstanding. I have come to expect that I will be listened to carefully and given appropriate and effective care clearly explained. I have been very impressed by how much information is shared on my chart and how helpful my providers are in responding to follow-up questions. A small rural hospital cannot, of course, offer every type of care. When receiving care elsewhere that is not offered by Jefferson Healthcare, my husband and I have been disappointed several times in recent years by providers who have seemed to take a rote or superficial approach to the health issues we've brought them. As a patient, I deeply appreciate the competence, the caring attitude, and the friendly good humor of all staff at Jefferson Healthcare. So more to come in Brandy's report about this great recognition, and just a huge thank you to all of our teams, every single one that just do so much to affect the patient experience of our patients here at Jefferson.
Thank you, Tina, and I echo that, and I'm sure the rest of the board does too. That speaks so highly of our staff. Thank you. Does anyone else wish to make any comment? Okay, then we will thank you again, Tina, and we'll move on to public comment. If there's any member of the public that would like to make a comment, would you please raise your hand. Alyssa is watching to see. You can turn on your video and if you're out there, and raise your hand and we will welcome your comment. I see that there have been no public comments coming in via email or snail mail as of yesterday at 5, so I don't hear anybody soon. I will go ahead and move on. Okay, then we will go ahead and close public comment. And next on the agenda are minutes from the May 25th commission meeting. And I understand Commissioner Kolff has a small correction to those.
Yes, thank you. In the part that references the Board of Health report, I would like the minutes to clarify that Dr. Berry received the Young Professional of the Year Award from the Chamber of Commerce.
Okay.
And move that the minutes be approved with that amendment.
Okay. Second.
Okay, is there any further discussion? Any other amendments to it? All right. All in favor, say, raise your hand, please.
All right.
It's unanimous. And they are approved as amended then. Thank you. So now we go to required approvals. Anything that any commissioner would like to separate from that? If not, may I have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. I think Bruce made a second. Is there any discussion? All right, all in favor of approval, raise your hand.
Aye.
Okay, approved unanimously. Thank you. So now we have a presentation on the resolution number 2022-08, which will approve the union contract ratification by and interim chief human resources officer Allison Crispin is going to present this to us. Allison?
Yes, hi everyone. I am very excited to present this resolution, and just to give you a few highlights of the new nursing contract. In the first year, we did an average increase of 9% across all wage levels. And we did sort of had a minimum of 4% and went up to as high as 16% in the different steps. What's really great too is that there are no more wait or ghost steps, as sometimes they've been referred to. So in the previous contract, sometimes if you'd be, you know, for example, at step 12, step 13 would be the exact same amount. So you'd have to wait a whole year to get another, or 2 years rather, to get a raise. So that has eliminated all wait steps. Over the course of 3 years, we have an average of nearly a 14% increase that goes up to 21% for certain steps. We've had an increase in preceptor pay, which is especially amazing because we've started to create these new nurse grad programs, which we've been able to make a lot of hires out of. And so being able to reward our nurses for teaching our new grads is amazing. We've also created a resource nurse position, as well as made specific clauses in there for cross-trained RNs, so that they each have additional pay for the additional duties that they're taking on. Next slide, Alyssa. And then really, really big, we have moved, instead of one step for every 2 years of experience, we now do a straight one-to-one ratio. So every nurse, when they're coming in, they every year of experience they have will get acknowledged by a step. This is pretty common in the marketplace right now, and we're so excited to be able to present that to our nurses. And should the board choose to ratify this resolution, we will be sending an email to all nursing unit members tomorrow morning that explains the process for changing their steps. And we've got 120 days to audit and make the appropriate wage changes. We're pretty excited to do that. We think it's going to give a really good boost to the morale of our nurses. We also are going to be doing a ratification bonus of $1,300 per contract member, and also prorated for their FTE. In addition, they will get retro pay back to January 2nd for those new rates that they'll be getting. And that is if they were employed as of November 1st of last year, just to be specific on that. And more than that, I really want to say we're so proud of the team. I am just the messenger right now. I was not part of this team. Corey, Tammy, and Tina really did the heavy lifting. They spent a lot of months and a lot of long sessions, and they really went to that table with open minds, and it's really a credit to the organization on both sides of that table what we came out with.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And also just want to elaborate a little bit on the one-to-one issue. We did have with some steps, they were 2 years, but they tried to match up the economic value of 1+1. So you could look at it from one perspective, and it was about the same, but it was just impossible to explain. And at the end of the day, our best explanation to the answer to the question, why do we do it that way, was, well, we've always done it that way, but hardly anyone else does. So just to sort of, even though the money didn't change significantly, did in some areas, but not significantly, it just made it similar to more places and easier for a nurse to look and compare, and easier for us to compare as well. So thanks to Allison and Tyler and his team for making that transition. And again, a huge shout out to Tina and Jen Peach Guzman and the entire group and Caitlin that worked this. It was challenging time, challenging set of issues, and also shout out to the union and the representatives from that team to stay innovative and engaged and committed to getting this done.
I have a clarifying question. So Allison, are all the wage increases included in the steps, or is there a percent increase plus a step increase each year?
It's a percent increase and a step increase each year.
Okay, thanks.
Yes.
Okay. And although the board does, well, first of all, I just want to say it's a remarkable document. I mean, the detail in this contract is just quite frankly overwhelming. So my hat's off to all of you who wrote it, much less read it. So the question that I have is, am I correct in assuming that because this is a contract with a union, that's why it comes to the board for ratification? Because typically we don't get involved in salaries of employees at the leadership level and all that. So is that my understanding? Is that correct? It's because it's a contract with a union?
You're not going to like my answer, Case. It's Uh-oh. Because we've always done it that way. I mean, it's a great question. as long as I remember at three different hospitals, there's probably a reason behind that, but let me look into it.
Okay.
Because I think it might, yeah, let me look into it, and I'll have a definitive answer for that.
And I'm not saying that because I'm questioning whether we want to ratify that today. But
yeah. No, and also your point about it is a remarkably complex document to read, translate, and even more complicated to administer. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the natural tension, and I would say between any management and staff workers, is that one side may want more language around standardizing workflow, and the other side may want more flexibility. So frequently the discussions are, and a great example is scheduling, where that we frequently have a discussion about that our need to have some degree of regular and standard scheduling in order to make all of the patient needs of the hospital work. And while there's understanding by staff with that, there's also a need and a personal understanding of, but my personal life sometimes changes. And what works for me this month may not work for me next month. And it would be nice to be able to. So there's give and take around that and language that, you know, would, that we would prefer language, you know, just, just speaking from the, well, we would prefer language that would provide more stability with respect to staffing and employees, understandably, would like more language around flexibility in their scheduling. So it's most of the complexity in the contract is carving out middle ground that probably is most friendly to both parties and more and most complicated to administer. And that's the challenge of these documents.
Well done. Well done on all sides. Congratulations to on a successful contract. Anybody else have any questions? Any of them? Thank you, Allison, for.
Well, I do just have one other comment that I want to commend the whole staff for having hung in there to do this, particularly during a very politically charged time. And I believe that this contract was finalized before the legislature made its decision. And so to have that come to fruition at that time, I think really attests to the dedication of both sides of the table.
Okay. Thank you again. Okay. And we will move on now to vote on the resolution. And all in favor of approving, well, may I have a motion to approve resolution 2022-08?
So move.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Is there discussion? All in favor, raise your hand.
Aye.
Unanimous. It is approved. Thank you. Okay. Thank you again for a great job.
Thank you.
So we will now move on to the quality report. Brandy Manuel, our Chief Patient and Safety Officer, will present that for us.
Good afternoon. Thank you. All right. So after that good work and Tina's good story, I get to follow with a good patient safety report. So we're going to take a quick fly over our big goals from the strategic plan. Again, our number one goal being to deliver the safest, highest quality care, and in general, doing really well, making good progress on all of the things that we said that we were going to do. The few that are yellow, and I just noticed a typo under environment, so we will get that corrected, but closure of environment of care items, Chris, and the environment of care team met earlier this week and have a plan for sort of revisiting those open items that come about as we do our rounding and we see opportunities for improvement. So we will, beginning next month, have a different way of tracking those, collecting data and reporting out to our leadership team and reporting back to close the loop more regularly than we have in the past. Otherwise, core measures scores continue to be very good. Our throughput times are the one area where we still have some opportunity for improvement. And otherwise, everything else is moving along well. And I wanted to take just a minute this month to highlight our performance on our heart failure measures. So part of our work with the American Heart Association through the Get With The Guidelines program is looking at the care we give to our patients who are admitted with heart failure. And in order to accomplish what they call an achievement award, one must achieve 85% or higher on these four quality measures, and they must do so for 24 months or longer. So we had just started reporting on heart failure within the last couple of years. Last year, you may remember that we were awarded the Silver Award, which is the highest you can get for 12 months of consistent performance at 85% or higher. And this year, I'm really excited to share that our teams did an exceptional job even through COVID and sustained that good work. So again, performing really, really well. And in addition, achieving 75% or higher on the additional quality measures that are reported to the American Heart Association. So this year we just received word that we were awarded the Gold Plus Award for our care of patients with heart failure.
Yay.
And last month, we talked a little bit about our current star ratings, and we were focused on the patient safety and quality of care measures. And this time, I'm focusing a little bit on the service aspect of it. So when we have our star ratings, there's the overall star rating, and then there is the experience of care star rating. So Jefferson Healthcare is doing quite well in both areas, and particularly in experience of care, where we have continued to be at a 5-star, which is the highest you can get. So what does that mean? The CMS takes into consideration a composite of kind of all of these measures that are spelled out below. Those that are in black are about consistent with other hospitals. The areas in green are the areas where we are above average or top quartile. And then the one in red is our one sort of opportunity to improve, although it's better than it has been in the past. So making improvement in how quiet we are at night, everything else was looking really, really good. So I loved hearing the story of Tina's letter, because it really sort of demonstrates what that looks like in the life of a patient. So taking this down to a more granular level, this is based on the overall question, would you recommend this hospital to family or friends? And we're taking all of the data through 2021. Again, this is focused only on the HCAHPS data, which means it's only our inpatient population that are responding to this. The yellow line is actually the top quartile score, which is what our goal is. And first quarter's numbers are still trickling in a little bit. They haven't closed out first quarter's data, though it's pretty close to being complete. So dip down just a little bit, but still really very good marks and really close to that top quartile performance. And the comments continue to highlight what Tina shared in her patient's story earlier, calling out the care of the nursing staff, providers, and even our CEO got an honorable mention this time around. So our inpatient team really doing an excellent job in taking care of their patients. And then just some focus areas. One of the things that is not on here that we've been focusing on over the last while is just with the transition of our radiology, working with Melanie to make sure that we're tracking really closely the quality measures around imaging turnaround times, and that we're tracking those just to make sure that we continue to reach the same high level of quality that we would hope and we've come to expect. And then some other sort of outstanding things or different things than we had on here last time. We're relaunching Team Steps, which I'm really excited about. So working with our education team to come up with a plan for kind of getting those scheduled, and starting with our leaders in particular. We definitely think that in order to sustain the work of Team Steps, the tools and strategies that we teach, it really is our leaders that are such a key component of that. So in terms of prioritization, we're going to begin working with our leadership team, and then we'll continue training everybody else as well. Our data team is doing a lot of work. Dunya is doing just incredible things with the data team. They had their second sort of retreat prep meeting today, where they're really diving into the details and looking at how we can be better at automating our data and getting closer to sort of that big goal of self-service data for our leaders across the organization. So they have better, clearer, more transparent data to make the improvements or manage their teams in the way that they need to. Focusing a lot on cybersecurity, continuing to see lots of threats out in the world related to cybersecurity. So Rob and his team are just doing a great job of making sure they're staying on top of any threats or potential threats that could be out there, and have been actively engaged in cybersecurity disaster drill planning, which we will be doing in the next couple of months. And then also our level 4 trauma recertification application will be due later this year. So our new trauma coordinator, Sandra Kelso, is amazing and has been working really hard with Jen Peach Guzman and our ER team to really begin to dive into identifying where we have opportunities to improve, and work with our data team to automate where we can some of the data collection that goes along with that. And That's all I've got, unless there are questions.
Thank you, Brandy. Is there any questions? Are there any questions for Brandy? Case?
Yeah, Brandy, excellent report. Do we have any information about how many other local hospitals, public hospital districts have received the gold standard from CMI? It's from CMI, right? Or no, for the heart attack care?
For the heart failure care?
Yeah, the heart failure care.
Yeah, so we don't have that yet. This is hot off the presses. We got it about 2 weeks ago is when we got word. And so in the next month or two, generally, they'll submit the report that's got the listing of all of the hospitals for comparison's sake. So we'll have a better idea in the next couple of months. One other area that I probably should have called out, but in terms of five-star patient experience hospitals in Washington, I believe only one other hospital in the state of Washington has five stars for that. So something to definitely be proud of.
Yeah, and I noticed on the slide that's the American Heart Association that gives the. Yeah, I just don't think that enough people realize the amazing number of awards and the excellent care that's documented here. So
every year the U.S. News and World Report has a full page insert that tracks all of the hospitals in all of the states that have been recognized by the AHA. And so the first time we were recognized, so it's this big grid and you get a dot for each one of the AHA Get With The Guidelines awards that you win. And so we celebrated that. And then this insert came out, and I noticed that there were several hospitals in Washington that had more than one dot. So then it has been this pursuit of the dots. The AHA has lots of different Get With The Guidelines and quality improvement programs. And we are, I think that there's five or six or 7-11 hospitals that are represented on the insert, but only a few that have multiple dots, right, Brandy? And I think there's only like one hospital that has more dots than we have. But we're not through yet.
So does that come out every year, Mike?
Yeah.
And when's the last time it came out?
It usually comes out in the summer. Do you have any idea, Brandy?
I think it's usually August. Okay. But I've got a copy of it somewhere, so we can definitely take a peek, and we'll make sure that when it does come out, you get a copy of it.
Yeah, and a link to that would be good, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well done, as usual. We're going to have to build a better wall in our new building, a bigger one. Our awards wall. Thank you. All right, we will go on now to our Tyler Freeman, our Chief Financial Officer, with the financial report. Tyler?
Hey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Go to the next slide, Alyssa. So, May, I've noticed as we've went through these the last few months, this can be a little bit deceiving because you look at the first page and you see there's quite a bit of red on there. But you also, if you look at kind of the bigger metrics that we're looking at, which when I look at this, I kind of draw to the year-to-date totals that we have instead of just the month, because there can be a little bit of fluctuation month to month. But the year-to-date actual versus budget, so FTEs, we're still running a little bit low. We're 9% below. Adjusted patient days, we're 2% above our budget and 57% above the previous year. So then adjusted patient days is trying to get at the total activity of the hospital. It is basically converting all of your activity into a patient day. And so we are quite a bit busier than we were at this point last year from an overall perspective. And then as you drop down into ICU, 44% above budget, 38% above this year-to-date last year, ACU 9% and 16% above, and patient days 12% and 18% above. So overall, generally pretty busy, even though there's some variation when you look down below at the individual department levels. And that that kind of translates to how we were our run rate for revenue in May. So on the next slide, you can see that we have total gross patient service revenue right at our budget. And when you look at some of the bigger departments, you know, surgery, 99% of budget, lab, 110%, pharmacy, 100%, ER, 106.5. So everybody is pretty close to right at their budget. And overall, we got pretty close as well. And revenue adjustments down a little bit or a little bit higher than where we budgeted at 2%. Charity care a little bit lower. Overall operating revenues right at $443,000 under our budget. And then when it comes to salaries and wages and employee benefits, those dropped down a bit. There's a few reasons for that. We, as looking through the data, you know, obviously, as we saw on the previous slide, we're still down on FTEs. We do have more contract labor than we typically do. We're quite a bit over budget for our contract labor. So some of that salaries and wage and employee benefit is dropping down into the line below of professional fees. And we also are somewhat not using overtime as frequently as we were in the past. So our run rate for overtime in January, February, and March, we were at about $350,000 worth of spend in overtime average. And that has dropped down in the past 2 months to $200,000. So improvement, but still, we would like that number to be less for obviously not just the cost reasons, but the amount of hours that means that our employees are having to work overtime. We'd like to get those numbers down lower. And then other expenses.
So how does 4.4 budget?
See, 6 regular number 13 is supposed to be giant number 7, 3 regular number 13.
Well, that was interesting.
I muted them.
Thanks. And so total change in net position close to where we have for budget, $211,000 under budget, and for the year we are $126,000 under budget, and for the year $372,000 under budget. And some of those metrics you can see too, like the salaries and benefits as a percent of net patient service revenue. After having a month where we had a decline, we're getting closer to that 65% marker that we really want to try and stay under. And then next slide. So days cash and days in AR, both trending in a positive direction. Days in AR still sitting or close to the 45 number that we have for our goal. You can see that that yellow top line has just been trending down significantly as Medicare has been withholding 50% of our remits as we've been paying back that loan. We've now have paid back $14.5 million of the $18 million that we received. So we will probably, depending on how good of a month we have for June, we may wrap that up in either June or July. So we will have fully paid back our Medicare advance payment in the next couple months. And then the other thing that you can notice on this, so we added the green line, which is our days cash when you include our estimate for what Medicare is going to settle with us at the end of the year. And you can see that now that number is starting to trend above our actual cash line. And so what that means is that our cost structure is higher than it was last year. And since we have a higher cost structure, Medicare isn't paying us a reasonable rate throughout the year, and we will have a receivable at the end of the year. And so right now we're expecting them to pay us about $1.2 million at the end of the year, which is, it's nice to have a receivable, but it's obviously not nice to have your cost structure in a worse position than it was the previous year. So that number will fluctuate through the year as revenues and expenses roll through. But right now we're seeing that shift start to happen where we're expecting a receivable at the end of the year. And then next slide for the board financials. Not anything in particular to note. Some of those audit fees from DZA rolled through. You just had the board meeting with Tom from DZA, so I think those were expected. Since we budget them just the same amount throughout the year, eventually the budget will catch up more to where we're at. And then last slide. June projection. So as of this morning, we're projecting right at a little bit over budget at 101.6% of our revenue budget, over $924,000 per day in charges. And for cash collections, still running a little bit low, but again, the Medicare advance payment is going to impact that as we finish paying that back out through the next couple months. And then 43 and a half days in AR, so pretty good numbers as we're at the close to midway point of June. Any questions?
Questions from commissioners? Bruce?
Yep, Bruce.
I have one, but Mike will probably answer it. Back on the statistics page that we got, you know, it shows zero mammographies in May. Is that, are we that short staffed that we're not able to do any?
Yeah. So, Mike kind of looks like he would just want to answer. So I,
okay.
That has to do with the transition with our radiology group. Okay. That we are arranging for mammograms to be done outside of the community, but that I didn't think that was the case for screening. Jake, are you on?
Yes, it is, unfortunately. Radia is doing all our reads right now, tele, and screening mammography is not something that they offer. So I know Mike talked about last time, we're, you know, in contract negotiations with another radiology group to try to get them here as soon as possible.
Yes, you were correct in pointing that out, Bruce. That is the biggest pain point in our transition from radia to Skagit radiology. I do know that we have been involved on many occasions personally helping patients get to Olympic or get to Poulsbo, but this is suboptimal and is a very high priority for us.
Okay. Thanks.
Any other questions of Tyler? Well, thank you, Tyler. It seems like we're doing well considering everything we've been through.
Definitely considering the staffing challenges and everything else that we have going on. And, I just went to a finance conference and have been to a few, and we're in a pretty good spot compared to a lot of other facilities, and some of the CARES funding that we deferred and have been recognizing throughout the year have definitely helped with that. But even without that, we've been able to hold pretty steady where others are in a lot of financial pain, but it's definitely a long road ahead, I think.
Yeah.
Case.
Yeah, again, if I could follow up on with Mike, who unfortunately is stepping out, or Jake, maybe you could answer this. My understanding is that we weren't looking to replace, to change mammography reading services. This was sort of sprung on us, and it's just been a challenge to find it. So I just want to make sure that the public knows that this is something that was unexpected. It was dropped on us, and we're just scrambling as well as we possibly can.
Yeah, we brought in Radia, 11 years ago. And at the time, and we were probably the smallest hospital that had a full-time radiologist on site. And initially, in order to do that, it required a subsidy to make it work for Radia. But we felt it was important that the radiologist be here. It was wonderful. Dr. Koenig did a fantastic job and patients were highly satisfied with him. The staff was highly satisfied with him. The relationship with Radia for telereads was great. And it was something that at any given moment, every hospital is struggling with, and we weren't. We had this steady, solid, stable radiology service. Well, Dr. Koenig is from Lincoln, Nebraska, and has family back there and wanted to return. And with the biggest change in diagnostic imaging probably over the last decade is this switch to teleradiology, to where the business model for many firms like Radia is they are international now, largely a teleradiology footprint. So hospitals larger than Jefferson and less, because of that new business model and also because of the shortage of radiologists, they are not renewing those agreements. So when Dr. Koenig announced his retirement or his resignation to go back to Lincoln, we reached out to Radia and said, okay, let's begin the recruitment process. And they just said, no, we're not doing that anymore. And initially said, we will sever our agreement on this date. Jake got in touch with them and tried to convince them otherwise, but they aren't in hospitals our size any longer. And Jake was able to convince them to continue to provide telerad for CTs and MRs and ultrasounds and really 80%+ of all the reads that we do. But the most glaring hole that we reached out to, particularly our general surgeons, was with mammography. We have been working steadily with Skagit Radiology. I actually was going to mention this during my administrative report. Had a radiologist on site yesterday as a potential candidate to be the full time, and are doing all of these projects are on parallel paths where we're recruiting radiologists. We are working with Providence and Skagit Radiology and our hospital in order to interface the new systems with Epic. And that was 4 months out, but we started this 3 months ago. So that process is moving along. And it's inching to the finish line, and we expect it to be done, 30 to 45 days from now, Jake? Is that fair and reasonable?
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, but every day we can't offer full-service mammo services to our community is not a good day. So we're doing what we can to get by and not feeling good about it. But yes, long answer case. But yeah, we were disappointed to learn from Radia, not entirely shocked that they were moving to a different business model, but disappointed nonetheless.
So I hear you say that Radia has agreed to do about 80% of, for how long?
Well,
definitely, or
until the transition is complete. They're being good patient-centered partners with respect to how our business fits with their model. And what Brandy referenced when she spoke of the quality reviews, we are monitoring the turnaround times on all of these teleradiology reads, because when you have a partner at the hospital, we used to rely on Dr. Koenig to say, hey, turnaround times in this particular area seem a little slow, can you make a call? And Bart would say, yep, on it. Now we are monitoring that because you sent out a CT part of one of those get with the guidelines stroke awards has to do with how timely a CT scan is ordered. Well, some would argue that the completion of the CT scan is the second most important part of that process, with the most important part being the read and the interpretation that follows. We continue to monitor those turnaround times and Radia is engaged, but I think that this will be better for all parties when Skagit Radiology is here, that the radiologist actually will have Dr. Koenig was a generalist and had this wide utility player, which when Case, when you and I started in this, that the specialty radiologists were the exception and the norm was the generalist. That's not the case any longer. Hospitals have a breast radiologist, a CT guy, an MR gal, and maybe somebody do all the rest of the stuff. Dr. Koenig was that with just a greater skill set. Skagit's model is they've got the generalist, but they also will bring a radiologist person or a mammo person for our breast reads, and proceduralists, interventionalists that would allow us to do more needlework than maybe we have done in the past. So I think we're going to get to a better place, but it's just subpar right now.
Thank you. Okay, any other, thank you, Jake. Any other questions for Tyler? Okay, thank you, Tyler, for your report and for all your good work. All right, we will now go to our administration report with our CEO, Mike Glenn.
All right, Brittany, we are going to start with Dunya's advocacy report.
Thanks, Alyssa.
Or Alyssa. That's right. I'm sorry. Thank you, Alyssa.
We're playing tricks on you guys. You never know who's going to do it.
All right. Can you start at the beginning? So on our state side, we had a one-day retreat with the WSHA staff and the rest of LD24 hospitals at the end of May to really do a deep dive into the 2023 session. So it was about a five-hour session. Jacqueline Barton True from WSHA staffed it. And I think that there were representatives from every hospital in our district, which was awesome. We sort of discussed what session 22 looked like, some of the things we might expect in 23, and then just sort of talked about how we work together better as a district to make sure that we're continuing to share information, that we're continuing to work together with our legislators here. We don't have any concrete ideas of what will come up in 23. Case, I'm sure you're going to ask that question. As soon as we do, though, we will get you out that advocacy agenda so you know what we're looking at. The things that we expect to see coming on are going to be around nurse staffing again. We expect to see another bill around that. We expect to see something around mergers and acquisitions, probably something about hospital financing. But really, it's so far out, but I think it feels really good that we are continuing to have those conversations with our hospital partners in the district.
Dunya, may I ask a question? Is this the first time that this has occurred?
It is. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow, this is great.
Yeah, Mike actually had the idea to start it mostly as a celebratory thing for all the work that we did in January, February, and March. which it ended up being virtual for a multitude of reasons. So we didn't get to celebrate as much as I think we wanted to. But yeah, I think Wish is going to use it as a model for other LDs to start talking through how to work together. So we plan to have probably quarterly meetings in the off season and then ramp them up to weekly or biweekly during the session with our fellow hospital staff folks, just to make sure that we're all on the same page and we're sharing information that we're hearing and that we need to get across to our legislators.
And how many hospitals does that include?
So it is five, all five of us. So OMC, Forks, us, and then Summit and Grays Harbor. Yeah, it was fun. It was a good time. We are also currently partnering with Representative Theringer and also the governor's office, actually, Amber Leaders, around a really difficult patient situation that we have going on here. It's one of the more rare occurrences that we have a very focused meeting with our representative, but he has been unbelievable in moving some work forward to help find this person a better place to be. We're really excited about that partnership, and we're excited that we had enough of a relationship with Representative Theringer to be able to call him and say, please help us. And he immediately jumped on it. So I think that has just been a testament to the relationship that our hospital has built up with our legislators and was really helpful in this particular situation. And it's an evolving situation, so it's not final yet, but we are very hopeful. Mike, do you have anything to add?
Well, we have talked about, and during the legislative session and during the last patient spike due to the original Omicron surge, that the challenge with difficult to discharge patients, and when hospitals were getting close to reaching full capacity, it was the temptation of officials in Olympia to ask hospitals, require hospitals to shut down elective services in order to create space for this continuing rise and surge of COVID patients. And one, we think that's a bad idea to start with, but two, we were able to demonstrate that for every one bed that was taken up by a COVID patient, there was 5 to 10 beds that were being taken up by a patient that had no clinical reason to be at the hospital, but they just couldn't be transferred out. And there's dozens of reasons for that. But the end result remains the same, where the patient is in the hospital taking up without a clinical reason to be there, and taking up a bed and staff that could be taking care of other patients. And frequently that stay is for a patient in mental health crisis. So it requires a significant amount of resource from the hospital's perspective and a significant amount of emotional investment from staff's perspective. And you know, you add all of that together in this day and age, right where we are at now, and it is just an absolute tipping point. The bigger issue is hospitals are, I don't want to say hospitals are the door of last resort, everyone else has the hospital emergency department to go to. The hospital emergency department and the hospital has to take care of that patient until the better site, the more appropriate care site, which heretofore had not been found and located mostly because it's not there, is identified. So with respect to this patient, creating a significant challenge upstairs, and all parties recognized that, boy, this is just not the right care environment for this patient. But a significant amount of effort with Steve to try to work through the maze of the state agencies involved, and frankly with the governor's office, because the governor's office has liaisons to some of these state agencies. And the point we wanted to make is that During the legislative session, there was significant concern about the working environment up on the floors, resulting from, you know, nurse staff ratios and just the stress of the care upstairs. And we wanted to make the point that a patient that we are unable to take care of, that does not need to be here, and is emotionally challenging, is a far bigger concern to our staff than the occasional working short shift. And I think that through our advocacy efforts that even WSHA helped us with, we brought the issue up to a higher level of advocacy, and not just for us. There's every hospital in the state has patients now that can be better served somewhere else. And every hospital in the state is dealing with staffing shortages where they are literally putting their staffing together on an hour by hour basis. So we probably were a little more aggressive with this because it's just, I mean this is avoidable, that hospitals are being run over by a lack of adequate resources, not only in individual communities, but in the state. And something's got to give, whether it be more money to these adult homes or centers, or more of a burden, a higher burden to get over before the patient can be transferred from their facility to an acute care hospital, and then therefore result in the acute care hospital not being able to take care of acute care patients, because that is what's happened. We have been at capacity and have had to transfer patients, not accept patients and take care of them here for something that we can, because we have five patients right now that are that meet that difficult to discharge criteria. So it's a thing, and this has to do with one particular, but it's the macro issue that we are more interested in working with Representative Therringer on.
Well, the thing is, too, Mike, is these patients are not getting the care they need and deserve.
That's exactly it. That is exactly it, Mari. It's not something we are equipped to do, and that creates the most of the moral distress that our caregivers endure is because we can't give this patient what the patient needs.
They need. If there's any consolation, the National Health Service is suffering from the same beds being blocked by patients because there's no social housing or no social or other placement suitable for the patient, whether it's a nursing home or a senior, like a foster care or whatever. My friend who works in that industry over there said it's hopeless. It's like the system's breaking down like it is here.
Is there any light at the end of this tunnel?
Well, it's really, really, really slow going. I mean, we deal with patient inflow and outflow in an 8-hour block. So we are trying to gauge the patients that are coming through the operating room and require inpatient admission tomorrow. We are trying to anticipate what the level of community activity that will result in inpatients to the emergency department, and just what else is going on. So we are monitoring an 8-hour increment and then staffing for that, where the partner agencies that could be discharge sites for these patients, that they work in week-long increments. I mean, it's just a completely different sense of urgency, where, you know, they fail to make a meeting on a Thursday afternoon, and they don't work on Friday, so pick it up again Tuesday morning. And in the meantime, 5 days of of specialty care where we are contracting, we may be contracting with security to help with, and it is just crazy making. So that's one challenge. Another challenge is frequently the rate limiting factor is guardianship, that no one has the guardian status in order to make the decision on behalf of the patient that the patient can be admitted into a long-term facility. So that is a function of the courts. And weeks ago, for patients, these patients have been here for 35, 40 plus days. And weeks ago, we got a court date that was like 3.5 weeks out, two court dates on different weeks. And then the court said, boy, it would be more efficient for us if we did both of these the same time. So let's do both of them on the furthest out date. And so the patient remains until that court system works its way through and guardianship is granted, and then the discharge can occur. And you know, that's the narrow view of the hospital, that it's these decisions need to be done properly, and they need to be done in a way with appropriate safeguards for the individual who may not have the capacity to make those decisions. But the way it's done now doesn't serve anybody well, and adds a significant layer of what we are all feeling now. And I think you're going to hear more from Dr. Mattern about the regional crises that we are in with respect to staffing and continuing to meet community needs in the region.
Sad.
Thanks, Mike.
Yep.
Next Thank slide, you. Please. Melissa. So the best and biggest news that we have is Senator Cantwell put forward our Jefferson Cancer Treatment Project in the full amount for the appropriations request for 2023. So $2.5 million to go towards a linear accelerator to support radiation oncology here at Jefferson Healthcare, which is huge. If you remember, we got 25 letters of support from our community member organizations. It was a massive effort. Thank you to everyone who advocated in DC and over Zoom and all types of mechanisms to get this to happen. So we're not there yet. This was the first gate. It was the hardest gate to get through. The final decision will be made whenever the budget is finalized. Most likely it's looking for November, maybe December after the elections. So we are going to continue to advocate for this. We're going to continue to call all of our legislators. So Senator Murray is an appropriator, Representative Kilmer is an appropriator. So they both have very big roles in moving this forward. But Senator Cantwell, yeah, so we are really, really excited. I hope everyone is screaming inside as loudly as I am. No one looks as enthused as I do right now, but we're really, really psyched. We have a letter that we've written, a thank you letter to Senator Cantwell, hopefully that all of the board can sign. So it is sitting on Brittany's desk right now. It just thanks her. It reiterates all of the talking points that we've had in all of our external messaging and thanks her for her support in moving this forward. So if you want to swing by Brittany's desk at some point in the next, hopefully, week, then we can get that to Senator Cantwell and her staff for pushing this forward. So a huge step forward in this. We're really psyched. That's all. Yeah,
this is very, very exciting. Dunya did a wonderful job with this. I mean, clearly, that when we advocated back in D.C., this was one of the things we spoke about, and Senator Cantwell's office was very supportive of the project, with the caveat of, you know, we've gotten over 100 projects that we want to support, and we can support, you know, maybe a dozen. I think that in addition to adding linear accelerator treatment, radiation oncology to our community being a strong need, Dunya is reaching out and getting, and plus our local municipal partners, the city and the county and Ron Allen and East County Commissioners, writing letters on behalf of the project. to that extent was instrumental. So it's the thing about advocacy is that if it's frustrating, it's like, you know, diet, right? If you want or preparing to run a marathon, if you want immediate results, you're going to be frustrated. But over time, and developing relationships and some degree of trust, we'd like to think that it's worth doing. And I think in this case, it's proven to be so. Case.
Two questions. One is, does this money, is this just the linear accelerator, or is it also the infrastructure, housing it, supporting it, in the basement of our new location? And then the second question is, what kind of additional support would it be helpful to drum up from the community, to either our senators, to Derek Kilmer, to whoever? I wonder if we have a plan for how to keep the pressure not only on Cantwell, but on everybody at this point.
So to the first question, so it is specifically for the equipment itself. Part of that is because of the timeline in which it needs to be. Jake keeps correcting me on this language. I say allocated, but it's specified to be used. So it needs to be spent within that first year, or obligated. That's the word. It needs to be obligated within the first year. So by September 30th of 2023. So because that's such a short time, it's easier for us to obligate it for a specific instrument. So that is that's just a part of it. Right now, it's anticipated to be about 40 to 45% of the overall cost. And so we are looking for additional funding to complete that. In regards to your second question, I haven't really thought of that. I was thinking specifically about the work that we need to do to continue to reach out to Representative Kilmer and both of our senators, Cantwell and Murray. But I will think if there is a way for the community to help support it in any way, I think that's a great idea, Case. I think that the project overall is an amazing project that I'm hopeful that our community supports. So we're talking about other ways to find the rest of that funding and seeing where we can help advocate in that capacity. But it's a good question. I'll think about it and come back to you next month.
The most important variable is just how big the appropriations or earmark budget ends up being. This was a huge hurdle to get over. Now it's a function of how much is carved out for all of the congressional delegations' appropriations requests. It's possible that there will be enough for all to be included. It's also possible, maybe even likely, that won't be the case and there will be a cutoff. So I think it's continuing to work with our congressional delegation. And, you know, we pitched this to all three congressional leaders, and unlike other congressional delegations, ours, at least Senator Cantwell, Murray, and Kilmer communicate about, they will not create their lists exclusive to understanding what is on the other party's lists. So their approach is, if there's truly 30 great projects in our area and in the North Olympic Peninsula and in Washington, let's make sure that we don't all identify the same 12. But let's try to give as many an opportunity as possible. So we were in front of all three of them, and Representative Kilmer thought it was a great project, wanted to support it, as did Senator Murray. And Senator Murray sits in a very influential chairman seat with the committee that will be ultimately prioritizing these. So, never over till it's over. But we sit in a, I think we're positioned pretty good for this if adequate funds are allocated for the appropriations budget. Is that fair to say, Dunya?
I agree.
Okay, Next slide, please. And I think I just have some budgets or some volume slides for you. I don't think I showed this last month, but I think one of the reasons why the call line volumes shot up is because we had our workflow for the Paxlovid. Am I saying that right? The antiviral. Did I say that right, Dr. Mannard?
You did get that right.
All right. It came through our call line, the nurse consult line. So you would call the nurse consult line. They would arrange for a consultation and a prescription for the Paxlovid. And it was during that period in May where we had a reasonable supply of the drug, and I think we were really pushing out its utility. So my hunch is that's when those calls shot up. But you know, still a resource for the community that that we continue to maintain. Next slide. Primary care and specialty care continue to stay really busy. And this is, you know, when we talk about staffing shortages, we frequently talk about the inpatient unit because that's where it feels like it is so acute. And it is. However, what our primary care colleagues will tell us that our primary care clinics and our specialty clinics continue to operate at a staffing level below what is budgeted, and yet continue to do amazing things to see patients. We are. I am less interested in this. If this a better way to track our volumes in primary care, in my mind, is 100% of of what is can be sustainably provided by the staff in one of those clinics, and that would be an impossible metric to determine. But my point is, we are allowing discretion and flexibility with the clinics to try to navigate through this period of high demand and kind of erratic staffing in some part due to unanticipated absences and in large part due to unfilled positions. That in normal times, we would look at these numbers and have some concern if they are below 100%. We are not at those times now. And during every SLG, we talk with Drs. Mattern and Butterfield about and Jake, how are things in the clinic? Sometimes we talk about ramping services up. Sometimes we talk about ramping services down, just to try to find this balance between meeting community need and operating at a difficult to predict staffing resource. But after saying all that, they are staying very busy. Next slide, please. Oncology, infusion, and surgery also continue to stay very busy. It seems like every other week there is one particular area that is of higher alert, of higher concern, and I think of staffing the surgery department now is. We have an incredibly dedicated group down there, or nurse surgeons, CRNAs, or nurses, surgery techs, and Donica and her team are doing amazing things to hold things together, because that's a service that that every day, 7:30 to 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, we are taking care of elective cases or just surgery cases. And then there's a call team. It's not at all uncommon for a patient to come through the emergency department, need emergency surgery, call team comes back 2 o'clock in the morning and takes care of that. And then sometimes relied upon to work the next day as well. So when you have a fully staffed care team, you have the necessary bench strength to make that manageable. When you don't, it becomes really fragile. And we are at that place now, and working closely with surgeons and with Donica and her team, and trying to hold things together during this difficult time. And I think Dr. Madden will speak at least generally to this during his report. But all the while continuing to meet the surgical needs of our community. Next slide, please. And the ED Express clinic volume, you can see that. Well, I don't know. Is that April 17th? I'm not sure. It doesn't look like it's been updated. Maybe it has. But what we are seeing an uptick in emergency department volumes, and so I think Dr. Smith will look at this and say, yeah, those numbers make sense to me. But I'm not. The data is, I'm not exactly sure how close to today that data reflects. Next slide, please. All right. I think this is the month when I need to recommend to the board a CEO succession plan. And, in the event that you have an administrator on Friday and you need one on Monday. I recommend Tina and Jake for the board's consideration. And I don't know in the past if what you have done with this, Jill, in terms of just if this is by way of a motion or what. So I will turn that over to you.
I think we've just accepted your
okay.
Okay.
All right. It's an annual thing.
Yes.
Okay. Sure. We are middle of June, and have got to the point now where we, with respect to our campus expansion project, where there are a conceptual block diagram that is beginning to reflect scale and potential block building design and proximity to services that I'm going to show you in a minute. The slide does a good job of showing separating the two projects from the 65 replacement, the project that we feel we must do, and then the expansion project. And one is colored blue and the other is brown, and I will point that out to you. I hesitate to show you this because what I can, the most certain thing I can tell you about it is that it's wrong. Is we are early in the iterations, and that we literally just saw this for the first time last week. And the architect team has captured many things that we are looking for and not captured others. So this is kind of almost a real time. I think I was seeing this for the first time. I think after I got back, these particular drawings, we've seen some concepts, but this is real time. But it's a place to start. So I will ask Alyssa to pull the document up. So this is existing. So the kind of turquoise colored roof, that's the existing 65 building. And next slide, Alyssa, I think there's another, another view of that. And this next slide shows a potential configuration of the new. And the light blue is the 65 replacement. So the blue that is attached to the ESSB and links the 1995 inpatient tower, that's where most of the replacement services will go. Then there is the closest to the parking lot, the corridor past the architectural design feature of sort of this open air courtyard, which you may or may not see again, but it's in this drawing. And then the blue roof line you see attached to the brown, that is the cafeteria. So the kitchen cafeteria. So the thinking is that it's particularly with this design element, that access to the cafeteria, a better view, sort of centrally located between the two new buildings, and maybe a 15-30 second hike from the ESSB and the 95 building. So again, that captures all of the services that are currently provided in the ESSB building. The brown big block structure, that is the expansion, the ambulatory surgery centers, the additional specialty clinics, and the kind of the room to grow. Our focus right now is the blue ceilings to make sure that we can come up with a design and a price for that portion, and then the specialty services building in the brown as well. So I'm gonna tell you next what you will not be surprised to hear at all, and that is the we were surprised at the projected price of just this, and that it I think we were looking at a project that we were comfortable could be affordable for not only district resources and community resources, and we have some work to do in order to bring that into range. If it sounds like I'm being coy, it's because I am, because we just looked at the spreadsheet for the first time on Monday and had a pretty strong reaction to there are elements of this that are just wrong, math errors and other errors that kind of in this good faith effort to get something out to us sooner, and so we are beginning to or 3 days into doing the work of first getting the pricing estimates right, trying to peg. I mean, right now the construction market is bonkers, but I think most people believe that it won't continue to be bonkers for the next five quarters. Included in the spreadsheet is a price escalating factor of 1.75% for each quarter of the next five quarters. Well, when you're talking about a $100 million project, that is a significant escalator. But at some point, and hopefully for the sake of our economy, sooner rather than later, those inflationary factors will flatten and maybe even come back down a little bit. So a bunch of price variables that we continue to work on. But the message you need to hear is the first run at a estimated cost was an unacceptable number, and we're pounding on it.
Case, you're muted.
Yeah, Mike, was anybody surprised to see that there I can see the light blue roof better on this shot. Was anybody surprised to see that so much of it would remain single story? But then it looks like as soon as you get past the ESSB, it's double story, and then triple story by the time you get to the brown. So was that a surprise to people to see that large area so far to the, what direction is that, south?
The light blue that's in front of the SSB is to the north.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about the brown.
That's to the south.
That's to the south. So was anybody surprised? Let me just say, I was surprised to see that there was so much of this so far to the south as opposed to closer into the rest of the structure.
Yeah, it's a reasonable comment. It is unusual to place lots of physician office spaces on top of or attached to a very busy hospital structure. So I think some of the thinking was, and you don't see, you might see it in the other drawing, unless you want to go back one drawing, that there was another access point to the clinics that would decongestion the building, but also case some sensitivity to the view corridor of the ESSB building that you becomes marginalized because you're right. It's like, I think when one of the first designs that I scribbled on the back of a napkin was, well, shoot, just build out the ESSB all the way to the 95 building. And while there are some advantages to it, one glaring disadvantage the medical oncology team pointed out to me is that view goes away. This is a exercise of trade-offs. Your points going up high, there's a long list of advantages to that. This design, there's a list of advantages to it. And it's sort of like pick what makes the most sense. And I think it's fair to say that we are challenging a lot of the either the assumptions that were made in earlier meetings or the architect design team made for us, mostly because of the, you know, was there a more cost effective footprint? Where you know it's sort of our nature as I explained it to the architects, that we are an organization that squeezes a nickel until two dimes comes out of it. So a big part of this has to be the most cost effective solution that we can provide for our community. But the thinking was there's going to be that we're up now to over 400 people check in that front door of the ESSB building. And I think half of them do so between 7:15 and 8 o'clock. so there's a deliberate effort to sort of make that more less congested, particularly for physician office visits. That's what we're thinking anyway. But well, your input is good, and you know we still have pencils in hand, so we'll communicate that.
Maury?
My question would be in regards to parking for this, for the Brown Building.
Yep.
Where is it?
Next slide. Alyssa? It would be down, we are looking at extending the parking availability towards on the water side.
Okay.
Where we own all that. We are doing the engineering. There's a bioswale down there that was thankfully over-engineered at the time. Probably a full third of last 2 weeks ago's workshop was parking, and we can extend out this way, create more spark parking around the building. Create permanent parking where the drive-through vaccination clinic was. So it comes together. Well, all at the same time, pledging more of a more active engagement and more active interest in reducing car traffic. So we'll build out all that parking and then, you know, work like hell to not have to use it. But, you know, I will caution you to get to that level of granularity. I think at some point that's going to be a crucial question and solution. But because of our timeline, I felt I needed to show this to you. If we weren't on such an advanced timeline, I wouldn't, because it is just the first glimpse that we've seen. It's going to look significantly different the next time we show it to you. But it's what we have now, and I felt I needed to show it as, you know, as part of the evolution of the project.
Murray?
And do I also see that on the brown box there are three levels of?
Well, that shows two levels and a third level as a shell space, but that the shell space is unaffordable.
Oh, bummer. I was going to say if it's smaller, why don't we just make it the same as the other two and have more shell space? Good try. Thank you.
Yeah, no, there's an element of healthcare that a certainty that I have relied upon in healthcare for as long as I've been doing this that has radically changed coming across my desk every day. And mostly it's in the operation side, but on the construction side, the cost of hospital construction right now is crazy. I mean, it is 3 to 4 times greater than ESSB days. Part of this is trying to get our heads around that. Part of the ongoing discussion about what goes in these buildings and what doesn't go in, you do not want to put services. Hospitals are not putting services in hospital buildings that don't require hospital licenses because at $1,500, $1,800 a square foot, that's a bad use of scarce resources. So we are trying to understand what's driving that level of hospital grade construction, and we were pretty precise about that. Like the ESSB, the emergency department requires it's I code, institutional code, for emergency departments and hospitals. So we built that, wrapped the emergency department with all of the infrastructure required, but the medical office, much of the medical office space is B2 code, which is mostly just medical office space, and does not require the same amount of infrastructure girth. Well, part of the exercise we're going through is did they design and specify hospital grade mechanical and electrical and plumbing systems in the big brown box, because that represents about 40% of the total cost. So lots of work to be done. I suspect I will be calling you together for a meeting middle of July, so we can have another bounce and I can show you something closer to what I think I will be showing you next board meeting, because at that board meeting, we will have to make a decision on going to Ballard or not. So I commit to you at least another bounce with something that I think is closer, if not the project that we think we can build prior to the July meeting.
Case?
Yeah, Mike, if so much of the parking is going to be down there, I wonder if there's been consideration of an entrance that's close to the parking as opposed to the entrance which now comes off of essentially the ESSB building parking lot.
Yes. Yeah, there would be access to the building on this side as well. And this thinking is that this would be employee parking. That if you think about it, a big portion of we are replacing 40,000 square feet and 40,000 square feet of services that are currently coming to the hospital and parking. So all of the blue is just swapping. Those people are coming here and driving anyway. I think I mentioned during one of my presentations, we anticipate about 50 new positions that when this, you know, 4 or 5 years lit out, when it's built and the providers are here and practices are growing, that an uptick of about 50 employees, but certainly more patient traffic to access those buildings. So it probably doesn't surprise you to learn that there are complex traffic or parking codes that, you know, are these formulas that are driven by square footage, driven by exam rooms, and all sorts of things. So it's a math problem that then you reconcile with what seems right for your community. And we're not that far off. We think the parking puzzle is going to be one we can solve. The bigger concern right now is, holy smokes, what's happened to commercial construction, how much of this can we do? Mari. Okay, Mari, and yes. Then we can probably move on.
Just a quickie, and you know, although I do have some knowledge of, but very little of construction, I've got other assets, not that. So is there any way, because, you know, we couldn't afford to do the top brown box, the half brown box, that there could be some mitigation to have enough strength in the building that down the road, when either this community became more affluent and we needed more services, we could stick another layer on top? Or is that totally out of the... I know I'm not making cake, so just want to throw that out there.
Yeah, that's something that I think probably every project considers and nearly every project decides not to do because it is so disruptive. So that the thinking is, if your expansion plan should probably not be that. But it's been talked about, so I think it's fair to put that on the table. All right, so more to come. That is my commitment to you. Next slide, please. So we had our first Leadership Development Institute LDI yesterday, the work that we have been doing to improve organizational performance and organizational culture. And I'm going to have Alyssa run through a bunch of slides that sort of capture the event. Yes. So Team Mojo, I think pretty early on when we were trying to, we had a difficult time putting our finger on what was the problem. And the best way to describe it was we just sort of lost our mojo. And there are lots of, given the healthcare world we live in now, there's lots of contributing factors to losing your mojo. But we ultimately decided doesn't matter. We got to get it back. So I think the group that's been working on this calls themselves Team Mojo. And this is our first LDI. So next slide. Lots of food. Shannon did a wonderful job with this. Next slide. What we ended up doing is that every leader created a slide of themselves that sort of was three or four pictures of who they are outside of work, what their passions are, what their interests are, and then answered three or four questions about what drives them. And it was remarkably effective at it's amazing what you think you know about people and amazing what you don't know about people and very endearing. So those were the part of the centerpieces in addition to the names of the teams. Next slide. So Mitzi did a great job as the new MC. I sort of kicked it off with this our way, identifying our way back and the dual challenges of being where we are at right now and the heavy grip of trying to meet the needs of our community at a time where staffing shortages are imminent and demand is high, while looking out 3, 6, 18 months into the future and recognizing that I think the healthcare is going to become more difficult. I mean, we're beginning to see this in the region and in the state now, where organizations are starting to make decisions with respect to staffing and services that seem counterintuitive. Like, oh my gosh, why would you be laying people off at a time when you don't have adequate staffing? Well, the organizations are starting to really feel the pain of the financial implications of costs rising, volumes having returned, and no more CARES money. The reason that our bottom line looks like it is because Tyler is allocating about $220,000 a month of our last CARES installment throughout this year. So the actual bottom line is $225,000 less. And I'm guesstimating there a little bit around there, less than what the bottom line we present. So we were $200,000 off of our budgeted net operating income, and that's after this $225,000 allocation. So we look better than our actual performance, and at some point we're going to have to deal with these dual challenges of how every one of us is feeling right now, the tremendous need of our community, but the very real financial implications of growing expenses and shrinking revenues. So I had the unenviable task of talking that through, and they didn't boo me off the stage, so I must have did okay. Next slide. Then we had a fantastic speaker, Craig Deal, who talked about the path that we are on and linking the work that we are doing with what he calls evidence-based leadership, 20 years of Studer and Huron work with organizations that here are the things that work and drive results. And these are the things that we're going to be helping you introduce at your hospital. Next slide. The next speaker was Nancy Arata. Nancy is the coach assigned to us. We meet with her on a weekly basis. The leadership team does, and she spoke about behavior standards. You know, we are really focused on reintroducing mojo to our culture, and you know, that can be a real complex equation, or it can be as simple as let's 50 managers commit to changing this one behavior today. You know, how we greet each other, how we greet strangers, how we manage meetings. You know, so Nancy led this exercise where if we were to develop behavior standards that we would hold ourselves accountable to, all for the purpose of creating a better work environment for leaders and employees and a better care environment for patients, what would those be? Next slide. And that's a great picture of the group. We had, I don't know, 50 some odd people in the, this is the Port Ludlow meeting room, and you can see we're all masked. So yay. Next slide. Breakout sessions. There were lots of breakout sessions where the groups did individual work. Next slide. This was the most popular breakout session. You can see Dr. Madden there holding court outside. Lovely day that we all embraced. Next slide. Is that it? Okay, so great start to that work. Just to start, you know, there's some concern that this is the flavor of the month, rightfully so. Well, what I reminded the group that we're, you know, we're about 15 months into this this flavor of the month. When we started doing the work in preparation for the last June's retreat, which was pretty heavy, and then shortly after that, we engaged Huron and have been doing this work ever since. So we plan to have those LDIs hopefully once a quarter. So when we do, I will give presentations that include more than just fun pictures, you know, the work that we're actually doing and our way of tracking whether it's effective. Operations update. There were two things that I wanted to talk about. One was the move to Kitsap Radiology and you know, that truly, that all of these parts and pieces have been moving concurrently, and not in a linear way. So the probably the most time sensitive was getting all the parts together for the interface, and that is, you know, that is moving along and we're like 3 months into a, you know, a 4 month lag time. So great work by Rob and his team to make that happen. The putting together of the contract, Jake has been on and really for about the last 3 to 4 weeks bouncing back and forth, and we have a document now that's that both parties are very close to signing. And then, you know, finding available radiologists. The primary reason that Radia is switching their model is that there's just a glaring radiology shortage. And that exists not only for the big firms, but also for the regional firms. So Skagit wanted to make sure that they could adequately meet all of our needs well before they stepped in. There are two radiologists. I mentioned one of them came and visited yesterday. Have an interest in being the full-time radiologist here. So that continues to move along, not fast enough for us, but as fast as it can move along. And then the second thing I was going to talk about, but I think Dr. Mannard is going to talk about it in greater detail, is just the state of the state and the state of the region and the state of Jefferson Healthcare with respect to managing care in this environment. I don't think I've ever received a letter from one of our tertiary care partners that says we cannot take your transfers because of staffing shortages or having other hospitals in the region shutting down services like OB because of staffing shortages. And then there are other things that are going on in the region that are impacting it. So it is a new set of challenges to me. And on a daily basis, Tina and Jen Peach Guzman and Dr. Mattern and Tracy Harris and Jake and a handful of other people do amazing things. I frequently say, borrow from tonight to make today work and steal from tomorrow to make tonight work. That it is this constant a shuffling of staff and the most important and critical resource is an incredibly resilient group of staff members that always pick up the phone and give us everything they possibly can. But it is a constant tight high wire walk that you just dread at some point you're going to misstep. But I think Dr. Mannard is going to talk more about that. Next slide, please. Is that it?
It's just the CMO update after this.
Perfect. There he is. Dr. Mannard, take it away, please.
Hello, Dr. Mannard. Welcome.
Hi. I'll go unless anyone had any more questions for Mike. But if not, I'll go ahead.
For your report.
I know a lot of my reports for the last couple of years have typically been COVID heavy and then some other things. I'll start out with a little bit of COVID, and then I think we'll probably just sort of emphasize a few and build upon a few things that Mike was talking about with regard to capacity locally and regionally and some implications for our staff. And so I think you're probably aware the COVID prevalence in the community continues to stay quite high for the number of infections. And a couple of weeks ago we were talking about how maybe the rates were starting to go down, but looking at the events and what we were looking at in Jefferson County ahead of us were things like eighth grade graduation, high school graduation, prom, eighth grade dinner dance, gallery walk, race to Alaska, 70-40. And there's really an appetite in the community and, school finishing up and finals and, people having to, be in place. And so it wasn't completely unpredictable that we saw cases continue to rise, and actually we're pretty close to about 1,000 cases per 100,000 population for the last 2 weeks. Imagine if I had said that about a year and a half ago, would have been panic, because with that would have been hospital beds full with COVID patients and real concern about the impact on severe illness and mortality in our fairly high-risk community. As I mentioned last time, that's been decoupled, particularly for Jefferson County. I think, we've over this last few weeks, we've had very few COVID patients in our hospital. I wouldn't say zero, but that is not what we've been seeing. It's not what we're seeing in other hospitals as well either. There's a higher incidence of people who are being admitted and found to have COVID as opposed to being admitted primarily because of COVID. It's not to say zero, and it's not to say that there's zero deaths that are occurring across the state from COVID still happening, but that is not what is the cause of hospital capacity issues that we'll be talking about. It's not that there's COVID patients in these beds, which was the issue previously, right? We couldn't, capacity was tight because so much care was going to towards people with COVID. So that is the good news. The bad news is that with high community prevalence, even with a work environment where spread between employees and colleagues is quite low from COVID infection, community spread is quite high, and all of our employees are members of that community. And as a result, and in healthcare, we take COVID infection pretty seriously as far as whether you can come to work or not. And so it's having significant impacts still on us from a staffing standpoint, whether it's from high risk exposures in the community. That is, for example, people in one's household who are, you know, coming down positive, people's kids who are coming down positive with COVID, or just from people contracting themselves, has significant implications for our staffing. And so it has been a real challenge that we'll get 5 to 10 employees back who were on isolation, either because of a high risk exposure or because they had tested positive, even though they're did not have significant illness, because again, the vast majority vaccinated and a significant proportion also vaccinated and boosted. But the issue just being the fact that the population we work with, we can't have you in the facility working with the with patients while you have COVID. So it continues to be a challenge for us in a way that sort of, if you go out in the community, you think like, oh yeah, everyone's got COVID, but like, you know, life is kind of, you know, moving along, which is there's this disconnect, and I don't think kind of people realize still sort of the pressure that it is creating on our staffing still in the community and in the region, quite frankly. A couple other things on COVID important to know. I think you probably saw in the news vaccination approval for under age 5, 6 months to age 5. We are anticipating being the primary location for vaccination for that age group, for the very young. We understand we are wave 3 of supply of vaccine that will go out. We don't know what that means date-wise, other than the fact that the vaccine for that age group has not arrived. We're anticipating receiving Pfizer vaccine, which will be a 3-dose series, as opposed to the Moderna, which will be a 2-dose series, but that could change depending on the distribution. But that's what we're anticipating. So we're already getting some interest in the clinic, and we're telling people that we're waiting to receive more information on arrival, and then we can begin scheduling plan. But we're anticipating that we will probably do the bulk of those vaccinations in the community and find ways to kind of work that into what limited capacity we have. But we do know it is important. We do continue to do COVID vaccinations, do as much boostering as we can. In particular, that is, I would say, for over 5 population, that's typically more of the vaccinations we're doing is rather than primary series, is that we're trying to make sure that people are boosted or double boosted. We won't know for a while what the vaccination plan will be in the fall as far as additional boosters. There's potentially a bivalent vaccine, which would be out, which would be for both the older strains of COVID as well as the newer Omicron strains, which are what we're seeing currently. So, but I anticipate COVID will continue to be a challenge as long as it is kind of churning through the community, because again, we can see reinfection even with mild disease, but we do know that the people who are still at high risk, the people who get the sickest, are the people who enter our buildings every day, people who are immune suppressed, people who are older, people with chronic medical conditions. And so healthcare workers, it's a different standard how we manage folks coming back to work. So that is part of the local challenge that we are experienced with staffing. So again, I've mentioned this before, we have a lot of healthcare need and we have staffing challenges. So we have staffing challenges from the standpoint of people needing to take time off for COVID. We also have people who have left or needed to cut down on the time that they spend working in healthcare because of fatigue. They're tired. We've had retirements. There are emails that come out every week talking about that this is a national issue around the shortage of healthcare workers versus the demand. So we have this kind of perfect storm of people are tired of working in healthcare. So we have people who are more willing to work, per diem or shorter shifts, or we have people who are just like, I need a break from this. It used to be that, you know, you're kind of like, well, maybe you're just, it's financially, it's a financial issue that you're not kind of, you know, willing to pay enough or, and there is more than enough appetite to, you know, compensate people well for additional work. The problem is that it doesn't solve the problem that we have a very fatigued healthcare workforce and money can't, you know, restore that. So you can incentivize people and you can incentivize them for a while. But the problem is that the long term is that there's a significant mismatch between the need for the number of people who want to work in healthcare, particularly the amount of FTE those people want to work, and the demand within the systems right now. And then the other piece, which is I'll talk a little bit more about, which is, and Mike talked a little bit with the advocacy, which is the kind of work that people are finding themselves doing. So if the moral distress earlier in the pandemic was seeing people go onto ventilators who could have been vaccinated, who had kind of preventable illness, and watching you know, people suffer and die, long hospitalizations, complications, and feeling that that work was hopeless. That work is less now. What it's been replaced with, and what we've actually had more all along, we've had less of that because of our excellent COVID response in the community. What we've had is left as the final safety net of care for a group of patients where a hospital setting is not ideal for their health and where our staff feel helpless to solve the real problem. So whether that is people who are severely disabled because of mental and behavioral health issues, frail elderly who lack an option for community placement, people with complex medical issues that cannot find placement at a specialty care hospital who will take their case. We find a staff who are continually frustrated and fed up and demoralized by watching people really suffer because they're not in the best environment of care. So we don't send those people to the street, even when we don't have the medical services that we can fully provide or that they would qualify for, because our services are a step above that. But we shouldn't not lose sight of the fact that being in a hospital for 30, 60, 90 days when you're gravely mentally or emotionally disabled is a healthy environment. We're not the residence inn. We're not a resort. This is a hospital with and these patients need constant monitoring and staff attention. And no, who's Mike? That is, but so the result is a distressing situation, because in some ways the environment that the patients are in can actually be ultimately detrimental to their health, because we see things like delirium, confusion, agitation made worse by the setting. So I'll talk more about that in a second. I just want to kind of talk. I think Kent, maybe with it. Kent, your mic is on. I don't know if you can hit mute. Thanks, Kent. Kent, your mic's still on. You good? Oh, there you go. You got it. So, so I just talk about some recent examples of stress on our staffing. The OB department had to go on divert last night. I don't know. You know, I've been here almost 20 years and have done OB. I can't think of a time that we actually sort of said that we were on divert. If so, I'd probably be able to count on one hand. Mike talked about the efforts we've made to kind of pull staff and steal staff and move people around, move pieces around to sort of, you know, steal from, you know, tomorrow to kind of win today. Yesterday, we had to say we have to give up today to try to win tomorrow. What we need is consistency in the next 2 weeks, and credit to the OB staff, the nurses who have created some flexibility and sort of what they're willing to do, and some of the administrative nurses who are willing to be backup positions at different times because of their own clinical experience, to the physicians who've showed some willingness to come in and be extra present in ways that they might not have had to be if there was kind of more consistent nurse staffing. So we have a plan for the next 2 weeks, but we got to the point for a day where we had to divert for overnight or be on a divert status. Ultimately, it worked out okay. We did have a pregnant patient who presented to the emergency department early in the morning. It was close enough to the day shift that we were able to attend to that patient and get them what they need. But it was definitely a difficult time. Surgery is another department where we've found ourselves facing a shortage of surgical techs. This is a difficult to fill position. There's a shortage of them. Traveler positions are on high demand. The staff has been trying to do some creative solving, particularly around call. We need surgical techs for call. We understand call is fatiguing. Call is part what contributes to burnout of the staff. There's been some question of, well, can we not have, you know, do we not, you know, have them not take call? That's not an option for us as a critical access hospital. We're not an ambulatory surgery center. We have a responsibility, and the call coverage overnight is there for emergencies, whether it's obstetrical, whether it's surgical emergencies that develop in patients who are hospitalized for medical reasons and then, you know, initially non-surgical issues, and for the ED support. And one of the things that I think it's important to understand is that just because if we say that we turn off a service, there's not necessarily a clear landing spot for patients at other facilities right now because of the shortages that they're having. So anything that we do with our staffing, we have to understand it's also in the scope of the bigger region. So we are piecing together some very creative plans around staffing and how the surgical techs may kind of split their time with call versus their sort of their day-to-day elective surgeries. We're looking at other incentives for them, making sure that they're compensated well. Hospice and home health staff, we're having issues with nurse staffing. We have people who are on leave. We've had people obviously have had COVID exposures. It's resulting in delays in admissions, and this can mean a delay in a hospice admission. And we're creating a plan of if those delays get long enough, what can we do to try to fill the gap, whether that's a hospice or palliative consult with the physician or nurse practitioner. But we're looking at very real delays and there's also capacity of how many people we can have on census for this very critical service. And there's not necessarily an overflow in the community. And what we know is that in surrounding communities, there's at least one hospice agency that will come into our county who I think at this point is beyond capacity and cannot provide that service. So again, trying to be creative and sort of looking at positions and who does what job. And that means as a hospice medical director, maybe that means I have to do a bit more of the paperwork myself as opposed to relying on some nurse help. And that's the sort of easiest part of the solution, but trying to find staffing so that we make sure that admissions take place as quickly as possible is a challenge, and we continue to work on that. And then finally, in the ambulatory clinics, we've had difficulty primary care, specialty, oncology, just staffing, you know, the basics, whether it's medical assistants or kind of front office positions. It means delays in handling some phone messages. We've been managing to keep pretty high patient volumes because the demand is there, but it's not uncommon that you have a medical assistant that's trying to room patients for two providers in a morning. And so what does that mean? That means that probably that medical assistant who would have gotten to a few more patient messages or MyChart messages and helped do some triage has less capacity to do those things because they're trying to manage. And so we are trying to kind of manage up, manage down based on those volumes. But these are the shortages, and we have some great long-term solutions in place, including training our own. We have our own surge tech staffing training program that we have. We have our own MA training staffing program that we've got in place. But these things take time, and the squeeze that we've got right now is difficult. So I think, again, for you, when you go out into the community, I think the message for the board is to understand that the experience, if people say, you know, it used to be, they used to get to the my chart message in this amount of time. I used to be able to get an appointment for, you know, within a certain amount of time. Things have changed, and it's important for them to understand that the environment, it's not that anyone's working any less, not as hard. In fact, people are working harder. It's just that the work to kind of keep the system up is falling on a fewer number of shoulders. So the regional impact, and I think this is what's really important is to understand, is that our story is really not unique. Pick a different hospital and you'll pick some departments or, you know, different hotspots than others. Mike mentioned that at the time, the message he's referring to was the Swedish system right now is essentially on divert, aside from probably some neuro intensive care cases that they would have capacity to take. But for the most part, one of our main referral hospitals is saying, we just don't have the capacity to accept patients. We're working on getting the rest of the regional bed report. I have a discussion tomorrow with Dr. Scott Kennedy, the CMO over at Olympic Medical Center. He was kind to say, hey, listen, if you've got OB trouble, we think, we've got trouble with that staffing, but let us know if we can help. But I also know that Dr. Kennedy will be talking about they've had difficulties with their emergency room staffing. And we've seen some patients heading east because of turnaround times in their own emergency department, which we anticipate may get worse over the next few weeks. So we know their challenge with that. Also know that Forks, we were on OB divert from one night. Forks Hospital is on divert of their OB service until tomorrow. And I have recently spoken with chief medical officers from Summit Pacific, Mason General, over in Snoqualmie, and over at in Ellensburg, and they're all going through similar issues, trying to keep critical services going. And it is one of the more challenging times. And I think, Mike can speak to this. And I think just it's important to understand that we've always been, pretty creative and always feel like we can, there's another solution that we haven't kind of, gone to, or another sort of trick up our sleeve or a rabbit we can pull out of the hat. And it's getting increasingly difficult. And just the difficult to discharge patients, creating this extra pull and weighing down our system. So right now, I think three patients that have been here over 30 days, and two of them tied up on guardianship issue, another patient that you had three members of your executive suite on the phone with state legislator and the governor's office. That's not normal to place a patient. So let's just, we are so out of the realm of normal here. If you think about the resource and attention, and that's just to try to free up one patient who has damaged multiple thousands of dollars of equipment, has required more than one-to-one attention staffing, hiring of extra security resources, has required the leave of some of our employees because of some of that moral injury that I was talking about and some of the upset and trauma. So we are having it's having an outsized impact on our rural hospital because out of, this is a 25-bed facility. So think about sort of what that does to our resources. If we were a 600-bed facility, we would be saying that is having an incredible impact on our services. But from a percentage of what our, staff resources and energy, it has an outsized impact on these small facilities. And Mike said, entirely preventable. The issue is that the work that needed to be done for a lot of these social services, so whether it's difficult to place geriatric patients who have dementia, late stage dementia, or other geriatric psychiatry issues, or the severely young, but severely mentally, physically disabled patients. This is having enough group homes, having enough solo placements, having enough you know, at-home care, 24/7 care, the funding for those things, they needed, the preparation for that needed to be happening years ago. And so the bill is coming due now, and it's falling on hospitals across our region. And I think the thing that makes it feel the most hopeless is that aside from picking up the phone and calling the governor, we feel, I think, you know, kind of powerless to manage this to some degree. So we're lucky enough that we've got an advocacy team in place, and thank goodness for Dunia. But, you know, again, it's not normal for your advocacy and your population health director to be coordinating phone calls to try to find placements for these high-risk patients. But that's what we're down to because we don't have other choices. So again, I think really when you kind of talk to staff, just understand, I'm kind of preaching to the choir. You're all super supportive and compassionate with staff, but it is a level of distress that you would think, you know, I think the community would be like, aren't you through the pandemic? You know, like, isn't it the worst for the healthcare workers? Aren't you done seeing COVID patients in bed? And understand that what we're really feeling is being the landing spot for, you know, some of the things that sort of ail us as a society. And I'm not optimistic, Jill, to your question, is there a silver lining? One of my test questions when I talk to legislators or people in some of these government offices, I ask, well, what's the projection in 5 to 10 years? What's the problem? Can you tell me, can you point me to the white paper? Can you point me to the statistics of what's the analysis of the population of Washington that needs, you know, this size of the population needs this much services? And people ask, people respond with, that's a really good question. So I'm a bit disheartened that not only does the state not have a plan, but that the state hasn't fully gotten their arms around the scope of the problem to develop the plan. I will end on that cheery note. Maybe I'll say it again. Very few COVID patients in hospital beds dying from COVID. So huge success that way. And, you know, again, we'll continue to work the problem. But again, also, when you see your directors and your managers, they spend a ton of time working these problems and trying to kind of patch these things together. And I know it's easy to kind of pick and pick on hospital administrators or hospital leaders or hospital managers through not understanding kind of staff burnout and fatigue. And, you know, all you do is throw pizza parties and things like that. But the reality is the amount of work, energy, and time spent trying to solve some of these complex and what seem like, you know, unsolvable problems, it really is a credit. And folks like Tina Toner, Jennifer Peach Guzman, you know, again, Dunia, you know, providing help, the house supervisors who will get on the phone, the discharge planners who will get on, you know, the amount of energy just to, you know, just that can get put into one of these patients is really pretty incredible. So. Did I mention no COVID patients in the hospital? That's right. So, all right, I'll be quiet now. Mari?
Yeah, is there any other state in the union that's doing a better job with this situation that you're aware of?
I don't know. You know, I think this is, we're so kind of focused on the region and in this particular problem. And because it is, so much of this falls back to kind of the state resources. I think it's a great question from the advocacy standpoint. I think as you kind of advocate and say, like, there's got to be a better way, I think, you know, that's probably one of the things that Dunia and her team will, you know, look at and will try to kind of say, like, so that you can point to someone and say, there's a better way. I don't know if anyone saw the New York Times article recently on Houston tackling the homelessness issue. It was actually one of the few articles that actually kind of gave me hope about something, which was a city, which that can be another one of those problems that can feel like an unsolvable problem. Houston really kind of wrapping their arms or getting their arms around and having some successful interventions in a way that other cities, I think, can look to. And so I think you do the same thing. I think you look to that and say, like, who's kind of figured this out, or who's doing a better job, or is kind of further down the road and kind of figuring it out. But again, I worry a little bit that I'm not sure that the leaders in the state have fully wrapped their arms around the scope of the problem of, you know, these individuals. And as we've moved more towards community placement for a lot of good reasons for trying to get people out of institutions and into staying in their homes longer, kind of understand the rationale for that. But I'm not sure people are fully prepared for what that means. And again, realizing sort of the resources that will take to make it happen.
I've got to say, I have never been more frustrated and more dispirited by the feeling that I can't do enough for our people. And at the same time, I have never been so inspired by the people that are here and doing this incredible work over and over and over again. It just really makes my heart swell. Is there any, Mari?
So to go back to your favorite subject of COVID, Dr. Madden, Paxlovid, that's been readily prescribed here with great effect in Jefferson County, doesn't seem to have the same prevalence of prescription in Clallam. Is that something that has come to, you know, or am I just mistaken in thinking that?
I don't know. I think one of the things that helps us, again, has been is centralization and ownership, right? So we have all along we've kind of locked arms with the health department and we've had a centralized response. We certainly are, we have the advantage of the fact that we, you know, do the outsized, you know, portion of healthcare. And we've been, you know, kind of the leaders in testing in the community. So we're situated to do that well. So between having the primary care base, having the televideo visit capability, having still a whole COVID triage nurse and MA hotline that can manage results, we just have the infrastructure to do it. And then also it's a priority for us, right? Because we have an older community. So all those things kind of align. I think it's a little, I can't speak for Clallam. I'm sure it's always more difficult when you've got kind of your Olympic medical group, you've got some private practices, testing might be, happening at home now. So that could be that they're calling one, they could be calling Jamestown Clinic, they could be calling Olympic. So it can be more challenging in other communities. I think, again, part of our success is just the fact that the way that we've, you know, one is just the fact that we are the main game in town, but two, also that we've taken ownership of it. So it would be the opposite if we just said, like, it's someone else's problem. We would be the worst. We would also potentially be one of the worst counties in the community then or in the state because there wouldn't be anyone else to kind of pick it up. So. But yeah, I know the report kind of around the country previously, I've seen the articles that, you know, the medications are not being used as much. But we have a higher risk population and we think it is part of the success. I mean, it would go along with the data and the tolerability of the medication has been quite good. Some people have been some of the kind of common side effects, but overall, I think that's been part of why we don't have patients filling up hospital beds with COVID.
Thank you. My comment is because I know of two people in well into their 80s with both had COVID and they were not offered Paxlovid in Clallam.
Yeah, and obviously I can never speak to sort of the exact around the situation, but what I would say is that the system in general has worked well and the fact that we've been able to incorporate home testing, which I think is really an important piece that we've incorporated. So I think, again, I would, you know, at some point when, you know, healthcare staffing is solved and difficult to discharge patients is solved, I think there'll be several of us who would like to sort of, you know, look around and look back and write an article to say, hey, we think we did COVID pretty well. And so next time you have a global pandemic, take a look at our playbook because I thought it was, you know, I think it worked pretty darn well.
I would agree with you 100%. Thank you.
Are there any other questions, comments? Well, Dr. Mattern, thank you for everything.
You're welcome. Yeah, no, thanks, staff. So if you're around and you walk through the halls, just take the time to give extra thanks. It really does make a difference for folks. Just let them know that you really appreciate what they do. And it seems like is that enough? But it's something, and it makes a difference. And when you're out in the community, please too, just really kind of making sure that the community understands still what the experience is here. And I think that in general, we've been lucky that we've had a lot of community support for the last multiple years. And that means a lot. It means a lot, but I think it's important that they still understand the perspective that we're and the environment we're working in.
Thank you. We will. That's something we can do. Mike, anything more to add on your admin report?
I can't top that. That concludes my report.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your report, too. Lots of information. Valuable information. Okay, we'll move on to board business. Case, you want to report on the Board of Health meeting?
Sure. I emailed the report that I gave to the Board of Health about Jefferson Healthcare's activities. I sent that earlier today to the commissioners. At the last board meeting of the Board of Health, which was on the 16th, we gave the annual Public Health Hero Awards, and I just want to mention one of them. One of the recipients was KPTZ for all of their excellent support of COVID-related programming, including the covering every Monday morning of Dr. Allison Berry's reports and fielding questions from KPTZ listeners and the county commissioners. Dr. Berry reported at the meeting on the extreme transmissibility of the current coronavirus. Fortunately, she mentioned we have one of the lowest death rates from COVID in the country, and in part that's due to our high vaccination rate, our frequent use of home testing and reporting, and the excellent public health outreach that the health department is able to do. The staff at Public Health is planning to participate in an intensive anti-racism course. I think it starts next month. The reason is because of the Gay Pride Month now and all of the work that needs to be done to help prevent racism. And Apple described some of the startling statistics regarding the trauma experienced by the LGBTQIA+ community. And I learned that the I stands for intersex, and the A stands for asexual. So this is really an important part of our community that needs to be protected and respected. And then finally, there was a report by Jeff Johnson, who is the new executive director of ORCA, the Olympic Regional Clean Air Agency. They apparently cover 6 counties in Washington. They operate under the Washington Clean Air Act, which authorizes them to enforce clean air issues. And there was some mention of the probable problem that we will have in this county this summer from the pollution caused from wildfires. Obviously due to the increasing consequences of the global climate crisis. And so I think that our staff, as stressed as they are from the current problems, they are potentially going to be seeing some more problems with asthma and other people affected from the increasing problem of smoke from wildfires.
Not good news. Hey, Thank you for that, for the report, and for representing us on that. Is there anything else from any of the board members, board business? Okay, then we will do the meeting evaluation, and then we will go into executive session so we can do a quick.
Yes. Jill, we don't need to go into executive session.
Oh, we don't? Okay. Yep.
Particularly if we are likely going to meet again between now and the end of July.
All right.
Which I think we need to move the project along. So my recommendation is that no need for my end, so we delay.
I'm certainly that's going to really disappoint everyone.
Oh, you know. That'd be once in a while I get to throw you guys a bone.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Then in that case, we will do our meeting evaluation and then we will conclude. Matt, you're the upper right-hand, left-hand corner.
Great meeting. Lots of great information. Appreciate everyone's time. That's all.
Maury?
Well, yes, it was a very good meeting. A lot of information and heartfelt thanks. For, I mean, I sit here feeling, I won't say somewhat guilty, but I thought, well, maybe I should still be on the payroll and not doing this job and be on last night because still have the license. I just cannot reinforce enough the sacrifices that our staff, our frontline staff, and the administration trying to figure all this out. I'm just blown away, and I say some element of guilt for not stepping up and being on the inside again and doing the work. So, good meeting.
Okay. I think you are doing a good job, Maury. So. We all have our roles, and I
know, but being able to stop some pregnant woman being diverted would be, in my book right now, a bigger role. But that's okay. It is as it is.
Okay. Bruce?
Yeah, not really much to add. I mean, good reports. I mean, mostly really good information, a couple disheartening things, but our hospitals are not alone in being short-staffed and having problems with difficult-to-discharge patients. Those are probably, to me, the most disheartening things. But also, you know, a lot of heartfelt appreciation for all that the staff and everybody's doing in these hard times.
Case?
Yeah, I totally agree with what Mari and Bruce just said. Just amazing what our staff is doing under the circumstances. And I was the presentation by Matt was so, the educational session was so helpful and so, timing couldn't have been better. And I applaud our delaying our own generative session until after that, because he has really given me, and I'm sure the rest of you, a lot of food for thought about how we can do our part to really move things forward.
Yes. Okay. Mike, how about you? Okay. Yep. Well, I agree with everything you all said, and I just, you know, I think back and I think we've been saying, you know, for almost 2 years, thank you to the staff and what they've been doing and how hard it's been. And it just doesn't seem to be getting any easier. And I just pray that this all comes to an end soon. It's just unfathomable. But at any rate, we just one step at a time, one day at a time. Is there a motion to conclude the meeting?
So moved.
Don't everybody all at once.
Well, then I'll second.
All right. Discussion? Okay. All in favor, raise your hand. Okay. Aye. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Mike. And Mike, you're the other one that doesn't get any recognition, enough recognition for all that you do and all the hours that you put in.
I get a lot of recognition.
Well, not enough.
Yeah.
Not enough. So here's right. Some.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
All right. All right. Bye.
Stay safe, everybody.